for and thought it too preposterous to be anything other than apocryphal.
Now, you seem to think you've been poisoned.
Breaking the Rules, The Markov File, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It did happen. It happened to me.
This afternoon at 3.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 16th of November. This is Lisa Costello. Good morning. Ukraine's president has criticised a decision by the German Chancellor to speak to President Putin for the first time in almost 2 years. Volodymyr Zelensky said Olaf Scholz had weakened the isolation of the Russian leader. Mr. Zelensky also commented on the US election results, saying he believed Donald Trump's return to the White House would help the war with Moscow to end sooner. From Kiev, here's our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
No one here knows exactly what Donald Trump has in mind for Ukraine, but they know that change is coming. Mr. Zelensky said he couldn't predict when the war would end, but certainly he said it'll end sooner with the policies of the new team in the White House. This was their promise to America. He didn't say whether Mr. Trump had made any demands regarding possible talks with Russia, but said he had not heard anything contrary to Ukraine's position. He was less complimentary about the German Chancellor. Olaf Scholz, he said, had opened a Pandora's box by calling Vladimir Putin. Now there may be other conversations, he said, exactly what Putin has long wanted. Mr. Zelensky could have mentioned, but didn't, reports that Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin spoke a few days ago, reports vigorously denied by the Kremlin.
Donald Trump has appointed his election campaign spokeswoman, Caroline Leavitt, as his White House press secretary. At 27, she's the youngest person to hold the role in US history. Our correspondent Jessica Parker, who's at Mr. Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida, says Ms. Leavitt is a passionate supporter of the president-elect.
I was just watching a recent interview she was doing, talking about Donald Trump's picks, and she was really giving a full-throated defense for those cabinet nominations. She said that Donald Trump, the president-elect, had made fantastic picks, so really coming out to bat for the president, and of course that will essentially now be her job.
A former Conservative MP has spoken of his guilt at giving colleagues' phone numbers to someone who'd used a fake profile on a dating site. William Ragg said he'd since suffered panic attacks and even considered ending his life. In his first broadcast interview, he told our political investigations correspondent, Joe Pike, how the man asked for the numbers after Mr. Ragg had started to message him earlier this year.
He said, "You've got a minute or 2 minutes or something to send me these numbers." And that's when it, as far as I was concerned, turned a bit weird.
Critics would say you made the situation potentially a lot worse and you drew other people into all of this and potentially made them victims as well.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that is why I felt the guilt. That's why I felt so sorry and shameful.
The family of the black civil rights leader Malcolm X are suing American law enforcement agencies for $100 million, accusing them of involvement in his killing in 1965. They claim the CIA, the FBI and the New York Police Department were aware of a plot to assassinate him, but did nothing to stop it. Here's our North America correspondent, Rowan Bridge.
Malcolm X made his name during the civil rights struggles of the 1950s and 60s. He was famous for suggesting black people should protect themselves by any means necessary from violence by white society. He was killed in 1965 as he spoke at a ballroom in New York in front of several hundred people. The lawsuit alleges the New York Police Department, coordinating with federal law enforcement, arrested Malcolm X's security staff days before the assassination. It also claims federal agencies had undercover agents in the ballroom who failed to protect him from the assassination plot.
In the past hour, the former world heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson has lost his controversial bout against the YouTuber Jake Paul. Fans complained that the fight was a drab contest, with some leaving the stadium in Texas before the result was announced. Earlier, Ireland's Katie Taylor retained her undisputed light welterweight title with a contentious points win against the Puerto Rican Amanda Serrano. Now with the weather, here's Simon King.
Thank you, Lisa. Today we've got some pretty cloudy skies, some outbreaks of rain, some drizzle, but that's moving its way southward and it's going to start to allow Arctic air to move in from the north. So turning colder today for northern areas, but by tomorrow, for all of us. So for southwest and southeast England, Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, it's cloudy this morning. We've got some rain and some drizzle. And that rain could turn a bit heavier for a time this morning across North Wales, the North Midlands and later further south, temperatures of 9 to 12 degrees. Across all of northern England, again, pretty cloudy with that rain and drizzle, which will gradually clear to the south. And there'll be some brighter skies developing later on this afternoon with highs of 8 to 12. Across Northern Ireland today, looking largely dry, one or two showers perhaps around northern and eastern coasts. There'll be some sunny spells, highs of 9 or 10 degrees. And for Scotland today, sunny spells but quite windy, and that wind will bring in some showers from the northwest. Those will start to turn a bit wintry later as the Arctic air starts to feed in, and top temperatures are 5 to 8 Celsius.
Time for a look at the papers. The Guardian leads with a claim that the growing addiction to unhealthy food costs the UK £268 billion a year. The figure, which is more than the NHS budget, has been calculated in a report by the Food, Farming and Countryside Commission. It found that increasing consumption of food that was high in fat, salt and sugar was having a devastating effect on human health and Britain's finances. The Surrey University economist, Tim Jackson, who carried out the research, tells the paper the cost is staggering. The Food and Drink Federation said companies had made significant progress in creating healthier options for consumers. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, is challenging Sir Keir Starmer on hate laws, according to the Daily Telegraph. She tells the paper that legislation must be reviewed to protect free speech. The paper highlights her comments in relation to its columnist, Alison Pearson, who's under police investigation for a social media post which is alleged to have stirred up racial hatred. Ms. Badenoch says it's absolutely wrong for police to visit a journalist's home because they've expressed an opinion. The Daily Mail has a similar theme, but this time it's Boris Johnson weighing in. He's written an article for the paper about police investigating comments on social media, which he says is straight out of 1980s Romania and the horrible curtain-twitching culture by which people reported on their friends. He refers to the thought police being like the Soviet Union at its worst. The former Prime Minister also calls on the police to abandon their investigation into the Telegraph journalist. And that's our look at the papers this morning. Now on Radio 4, Claire Balding is here with Ramblings. And this week, it's one of the walkers making the introductions.
OK, guys, I think we're ready to start. OK, welcome to this, the 100th Old Lags Walk. I think when we started in... when we started in August 2012, I never thought, never dreamt we'd ever get to 100. So Graham's going to lead the walk today, and Jim Scotts is going to do the historical facts of sights we've come across on the walk. Lead on, okay. Graham, lead on. Right. Don't get us lost.
Introducing the walk, there was David Miller, who is our leader of the Old Lags group. So, David, you better explain what it is, because we've got, 36 people 36 here today. Yeah, yeah. How do you all know each other?
So the group basically started their careers in the 70s and 80s, working for the CEGB, Central Electricity Generating Board, nationalised industries responsible for providing electricity throughout England and Wales. And then CEGB was privatised in the 90s, and we then divided into various companies. And predominantly, people on the walk now, the group, all work for companies supporting the nuclear power stations. So that's the history of the group, really. And so this group is really like really the CGB back together again.
And when everyone retired, was it your idea to regularly meet up for a walk?
So, well, it's when I retired. I knew a few guys who were keen walkers, so I just suggested them, do you fancy meeting up for a walk? So that kicked off the first walk. It was in August 2012 in the Wye Valley. And we had 9 people on that walk. And for memory's sake, we repeated again this year in July. We had 27.
If you want to follow us on the walk, we're on OS Explorer 154, which is Bristol West and Portishead. And we started the walk at grid reference ST554730.
So we're in Lee Woods, which is a big National Trust wood on one side of the Avon Gorge. And there's lots of walking in here. This route we're doing now is just a short circuit, which takes you a nice vista point overlooking the Clifton Observatory and the Suspension Bridge. And then we'll come back down and go down Nightingale Valley to hit the river, into the docks that way.
Hi there.
And there's a little poodle running towards a little grey poodle. Lots of people in here dog walking. And the group ahead has separated itself now into just almost single file, and like a snake wending its way through these paths up and down the various ditches. But yeah, the leaves really starting to tumble now, and they've gone very pale yellow, a lot of them, as we turn from autumn into winter. So what I'm going to have to today, because it's such a big group, is just peel people off almost at the back. And Brenda, you are my first victim. So tell me about your working life, and indeed about meeting up with everyone again.
Well, I came to England at the age of 21 from India. Went to Manchester University, and that's where I met Dave Miller. And as it happens, we joined the same company. Lived in London for 47 years, moved to Bristol just over 2 years ago, and happened to be next door neighbour to Dave. And there is this group of friends, ex-colleagues who live here, and they made my life, you know, very easy, move very easy.
So what was life like when you first arrived here? Did you come with the whole family, or were you on your own?
No, I came on my own. I'd graduated in India. I got a scholarship to come to Manchester. So I arrived with £2.50 in my pocket on my own.
Oh, gosh.
That was as much as the bank would allow to take out in foreign currency at the time. This was 1970.
Yeah, but
things
still, £2.50 didn't buy you that much in 1970.
Well, my annual grant was £550. I wasn't allowed to work here, so I had to live on £550 for the whole year. And that was manageable. When I arrived, I met a girl who became my wife. She was Mancunian. And she had come to induce newcomers to Manchester. 2 years later, we got married, and I got a job with CGV, and I stayed with that company and its successors for 43 years.
Uh-huh. And how did you find it as a working environment?
Initially, challenging, because I did suffer in that sort of initial stage resistance, you know, sort of racing. People kept, you know, asking me questions like, why are you here? Why don't you go home? Don't forget, the 70s was a time when it wasn't uncommon to go to look for digs and find, you know, being told there are no blacks, no Irish, no dogs. So, you know, it sign of times. I was one of the few engineers of colour at PhD level in the company. So people just assumed that I was a technician. But that changed. And as you can see, a lot of friends, they made life easier. And the rest is history, really.
Ooh. Looks like everybody's stopping. We've got a vantage point here, just at the edge of the woods, looking out over Bristol. We can see the Clifton Suspension Bridge really clearly, and the Avon Gorge. And I think, Jim's going to do a bit of history for us.
Right, so the building over on the top there is the observatory. That was a sort of corn mill and a snuff mill built in 1760. And unfortunately, they left the sails up during a gale, and it turned around so fast that it caught fire. Burnt down, it was left for about 100 years, and then an artist bought it, and he installed telescopes in it, and also it's got a camera obscura in the top, so that sort of, in Victorian times, it still working now, it sort of projects an image of the surrounding countryside onto a sort of 6 feet hemispherical dish, and it's like looking at a sort of colour cine.
So the woodland we're walking in, Lee Woods, is about 80 acres. It's It's a site of special scientific interest, but also historic interest. And actually, there's an Iron Age fort just to the left of us. You can still see the ramparts rising up, but it is the most wonderful space for walking, whether or not you're noticing the, you know, the history of it. And Sally, this is a wonderful gathering, but do you have your favourite walks? Is this a good one? Have you done this one before?
We did walk through Lee Woods once before, but it was a while ago. I enjoy all the walks we come on, actually, because the countryside is so diverse. We usually walk somewhere between the Malverns and the Mendips, because people live in such a wide area.
Yeah. I was talking to Brendra about his experience of working in this environment in the 70s. Can I ask about how you got started, and were you rare in being female?
Very much so. It was when I went to secondary school that I discovered that I could actually do something called physics. And up to that time, I was very mediocre. So when I was offered a job at Berkeley Nuclear Laboratories at the age of 18, I took it. And in those days, the CGB believed in educating people, and I was sent for a couple of years day release to do my HNC in applied physics. And then they sent me to London for a year, full time, to take my graduateship of the Institute of Physics exam. And I worked at Berkeley Labs until I was expecting my first child. I met my husband there as well. Then I had to give up work because in those days you didn't work if you had children. Full stop.
And that's it? You weren't expected to go back?
I wasn't expected to go back at all. But 13 years later, I actually did go back to work. And I was back at work for 31 years after that. We happened to be up at in North Lancashire at that time because my husband was commissioning the Heysham power stations. And I used to go to classes instead of coffee mornings. And I was doing an A-level at the Adult Education Centre and picked up a leaflet about bursaries given by the manpower services to get women who had given up work to have their children to get them back into work again.
And you felt this was written for me, you said.
Yes.
This is for me.
Yes. So the bursary included a year's study with the OU, Open University, and a preliminary weekend at Loughborough University where we did things like time management, how to bring up a family and work, CV writing, which I hadn't done for 20 years. And so that's how I got back to work.
It's a very, very popular area. There's lots of children out walking with parents and grandparents. It's a really great space, but also the path that the group are walking on ahead of us, going underneath beech trees, and the whole of the bottom of it, it's like a channel just covered in leaves, so very, very soft underfoot. So what was the job that you applied for? Was to do what specifically?
Well, it was to work in the engineering department at Heysham Power Station, doing day-to-day running of the power station, really. Mm-hmm. Collecting data, making sure everything was okay from the reactor's point of view.
And on a practical level, there's protective kit that you've got to wear.
Oh yes, yes. You have hard hats, boiler suits, toe-protected shoes. But the trouble was, I was quite small as far as boiler suits were concerned. They didn't seem to do any for ladies. The crotch was down at my knees. So I took it home and got my sewing machine out, took the sleeves up, took the legs up, took the waist up, and so that it fitted.
I mean, that's a sign of how rare you were in the industry.
Yes,
you
yes.
Know. And how long is it since you retired?
7 years. I actually worked up till the age of 70. I should have retired at 60, But as I came up to 60, the Sex Discrimination Act came in, and men were allowed to work till 65. So I decided to work till 65. And then as I came up to 65, the Age Discrimination Act came in. So they couldn't get rid of you on age grounds.
But hey, you made up for the 13 years that you missed that you didn't want to miss.
Exactly, exactly. Which I had no choice about.
We're dropping steeply downhill into the mouth, if you like, of the gorge. This is Nightingale Valley, and there are the trunks of trees stretching upwards on the bank on the right, and again a sort of bed of brown leaves giving it this amazing coppery glow. The path quite narrow here. There are some steps behind us, and I think it would have been a good idea to have a stick, to be honest, because they could get quite slippery. You're listening to Ramblings on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. I'm walking with a group called the Old Lags, and they all used to work for the CEGB, which is the Central Electricity Generating Board. It then got split into lots of different private companies, but they want to stay together. So they meet regularly. This is their 100th walk, and we're on the outskirts of Bristol, about to walk under the Clifton Suspension Bridge. The benefit of the leaves falling off the trees is that we can see everything. The downside is we can also hear everything, so it's quite a noisy road on the other side of the gorge. But right above us, this towering structure of the suspension bridge. And John Jones is with me because you know a bit about this. This was a turning point in engineering, wasn't it?
Brunel was a brilliant person, but not only was he brilliant, he was really courageous. In building this bridge, the first thing they had to do was put a rope across, so they would have brought it across in a boat. But then when it was tight, it was Brunel that was the first person that crossed it, just to show everybody that the rope would take the weight. And ropes weren't what they are now. So had it snapped, he would have been coming down against these rocks. Ooh. And it would have been certain death.
He was only 24, I think, Eisenberg, Kingdom Brunel, when he got this commission. And I think he then referred to it always as his baby, that this was the first of many amazing structures.
It made his name, didn't it? And you can see why. It's a beautiful structure.
And it's about just over 400 metres across, I think.
You feel giddy when you're crossing it. I cycled across it this morning, and you don't really want to look at the view. You just want to get to the other side.
When you were working, John, which power station did you work at?
I didn't work at power stations. I first of all lectured at the Royal Naval College in Greenwich, and then I went to the central design offices in Gloucester, and I worked there until I joined the Office for Nuclear Regulation, where I was looking after the fuel and the reactor core design. So I looked at a lot of the new reactors, and I tried to decide what was okay and what needed to be improved.
That is a job of such massive responsibility.
Yes, sometimes you have to make really large decisions. I had to make the decision on whether it was acceptable to dry store the fuel after it had come out of the reactors. And they changed the design of the fuel so that we had to look at the technical aspects in quite a lot of detail to come to that decision. But in the end, there's a judgment to be made.
And you've got to be brave and make it.
You've got to be ready to make it, and you've got to look at the broader context, because we need energy, and energy is a dangerous thing to produce. I grew up in South Wales alongside a coal seam, which they used to call the Black Seam. And it was the Black Seam, not because the coal was black, but because of the number of people that died.
Gosh. Well, and also you had a very close connection, didn't you, with Aberfan?
Indeed, yes. My grandfather was a mine safety inspector. He tried to stop the coal tip being built on Aberfan, and unfortunately failed. He knew that on a very wet day, there would be springs, and they were putting the coal waste on part of the hill above what would be a spring. So he was concerned that the waste would get fluidized and come down the hill and engulf the village. Now, eventually, that is exactly what happened, and it completely covered the primary school. Hundreds of children and teachers were, well, not hundreds of teachers, but hundreds of children were killed as a result. So, yes, I'm very conscious of the fact that safety is something that you just can't take for granted.
But it's not surprising that something like that is going to affect your outlook, particularly with your grandfather not being listened to. And I suspect that many people working in, you know, jobs as you did, make what they see as the correct call and offer advice that then isn't followed. I suspect that happens all the time. How do you make sure that your recommendation is taken note of?
Yes, his career suffered as a result of trying to stand in the way of that. And I think you have to stand on principle. But I think the key thing is patience, because over time, people do come around to your view. Maybe they don't do initially, but eventually they get to see the logic.
The urban noises are increasing in volume because we've crossed the Avon River and come over onto the side where obviously the city of Bristol is. We're walking east up the channel of water created by the lock, so into what would have been once a very active harbour. There's a rather beautiful timber fish and chip building underneath the bridge on the right. And beyond it, these massive old... What would they have been, David? David Bennett's alongside me.
These bonded warehouses.
Okay.
So the tobacco that came in for the Wills factory, tobacco factories, was held there until Wills paid the bonds to get the tax to get the tobacco released for cigarette manufacture. So they were paying at the peak something like £1 million a day of tax that was going to the government. For such was the scale of the tobacco industry here.
We can see just on the hill, it's quite a hilly city, Bristol, and you look up at those houses, they're really brightly coloured, yellows and blues and oranges and greens, very, very vibrant.
It's very much an iconic view of Bristol with those coloured houses there. It's you'll find that on lots of postcards. Quite desirable.
Yeah, very. We paused at the black gates of the Great Western Dockyard, through the bars of which I can see Bristol's top tourist attraction, which is the SS Great Britain, designed by Brunel. It's black and gold, and it's been restored to the quality and the grandeur that it had on its launch day. Six masts, which are sort of pale yellow in colour, almost beige and black-topped, and flags off every rope. So I think we're walking now into the heart of the city centre. David, this has been a terrific route. And did you choose Bristol especially for the 100th walk?
Well, yes, I did. A bit selfishly, really, because I live in Bristol. And I thought for the 100th walk, then it would be a reasonable thing to go on a bit of a pub crawl afterwards. There's quite a few local Bristolians as well, so that's the plan. We're going to do a few pubs in Clifton afterwards. That's why we're doing it, yeah.
What have your routes been like from when you started it? You must have covered a huge number of different areas.
So we've covered the Cotswolds, north of Chutton, all the way down to Bath, the Bath area, the Bristol area, the Mendips, the Wye Valley, Brecon Beacons, and the Severn Vale along the side of the River Severn. So many, many walks. In terms of some memorable walks, where we had... influence of nature, I suppose. We did one walk in February 20. It was from Alst to Albury inland and back along the Severn Way. And the weekend before the walk on the Monday, there's a major storm. And we came across a track totally covered in water, which was too deep for us to walk through, even with boots on. So we had to clamber up on a little side and hang on to branches going across it. And we all managed that except for one person, and it was his very first walk. And the branches gave way, and he fell back into the cold water in February, totally drenched from head to toe. But we helped him when we got to the pub and gave him wet gear, etc. And the other nature-driven walk was we went to Crickhowell. It was in November. When we got on the ridge, there was a temperature inversion so that the valley was in clouds and we're above the clouds, and so were all the peaks of the Brecon Beacons like Sugarloaf and Table Mountain. Wow. They're stunning. Yeah. And then we're all stood there as a group. When we looked down, we could see our shadow on the clouds, but we were surrounded by a rainbow. And it turned out to be a phenomenon called the Brocken Spectre. And here's a picture of it, Claire, so you can see it. It's called the Brocken Spectre.
Like a huge sort of halo
around us, yeah.
Yeah.
We thought, what is this, you know?
Wow.
It's stunning.
Doesn't that look like it's sea below you?
Yeah.
Fact, it's
the clouds,
cloud.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. You must be very proud of what this has become.
Yes, I suppose so, in terms of it's enabled people who come on it to maintain contacts with people from work they've known for years, and without this they'd probably lost that contact.
And the social aspect, really important, so I know you lot are all heading off for lunch, so I shall leave you here. Thank you. Thank you so much for letting me come along and join your 100th walk. I hope you're going to have a fantastic lunch at the pub. And safe walking back after that bit. Thanks. Lovely.
Ramblings is presented by Claire Balding and produced by Karen Greger. It's a BBC Studios audio production.
Take a moment with BBC Radio 3 Unwind, the new destination for music to unwind your mind. Set yourself up for the morning with Dr. Sian Williams' selection of soothing classical tracks. And join Oliver Arnold's as you wind down in the evening with ultimate calm.
Music that can bring complete peace of mind.
Radio 3 Unwind. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now on Radio 4, it's Farming Today This Week with Kaz Graham.
Hello. Coming up today, with farmer protests expected next week, the row over inheritance tax gets political.
What DEFRA was saying is surely we could have a system that farmers that are older, farmers in their 80s, we could maybe have some sort of exemption from them. But the very clear message I got when I looked into this from the Treasury was no change, no mitigations.
6 months into the new Scottish Agriculture Act and farmers say they're still in the dark.
There's a lack of confidence and clarity as to what will our sort of future support network look like in Scotland. It's difficult to try and encourage confidence in younger people to go to a more environmentally linked payment system. Then that concerns me, because not everybody will be able to undertake the measures in which may well be needed.
And the tiny island looking for a farmer to take over its tiny dairy.
Sark wants to be as independent as it can possibly be. So having a self-sustaining business for the dairy industry makes absolute sense. I would wish to have as little imported to the island as you can possibly get.
First today, though, the 9,500 acres of the Rothbury estate in North Northumberland was described as the largest block of land to come on the market in England in the last 30 years. Now it's been announced that the Wildlife Trusts have bought part of it and begun a £30 million appeal to buy the rest. The two-phase acquisition includes 12 tenanted upland farms, where often the same family have lived and farmed for generations. So what does this change of ownership mean for them? Our reporter Jo Lonsdale has been there to meet Mike Pratt, the Chief Executive of Northumberland Wildlife Trust, to find out more about their plans.
So we've come to Lawdon Shores, which is on the western end of the estate, and behind me, the Simonside Hills. In the stones around us are some of the cup and ring marks, the prehistoric art that shows that this land has been lived in for thousands of years. Mike, are you sort of pinching yourself that you've actually bought all this?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm so excited about this whole potential of this place because we realise it's a once-in-a-generation opportunity. This is for everybody, both locally and nationally.
This is a land which is largely farmed by tenant farmers. Let's hear the view of one of them, a tenant farmer who, not within this estate, but farms close by. And this is his nervousness, really, about the project.
Hi, I'm Mark Mather. I'm a tenant farmer and a county councillor. I think it's my concerns are for the people that live there and work there. We need to ensure that their voices are heard and are taken seriously. Well, I think the concern in the industry is it's either green agenda or it's agriculture. And what we don't want to do is to remove those people and lose our generations of knowledge about the land and about the industry. It's the unknown. The name Wildlife Trust just, you know, makes you feel slightly nervous. The sheep industry is getting a lot of pressure and, you know, we need to protect that industry. We've heard recently about declining numbers in breeding stock and the availability of breeding stock going forward. And larger states like this, if it does go down the route of reduction in sheep numbers, that will only add to those pressures.
Mike, is your long-term vision more a rewilded landscape, a landscape perhaps with more trees on and fewer sheep? I mean, we're surrounded by sheep here. That's how people farm here.
Well, it's going to be different, obviously. We haven't just bought all of this just to keep it exactly the same. But obviously, we want to work with farmers and the community to see how we can continue farming, but also get nature benefits and actually reward those farmers for actually helping us get more nature, more biodiversity and abundance back in this land. We want to have, obviously, more broadleaf woodland connecting along the riverways. So, yes, there'll be some change, but within that, there will be a farm landscape as well.
What would you say to people who say land should be about food production, not necessarily prioritising nature?
Well, I would say that increasing biodiversity actually helps that happen. You know, we need to look after our soils a lot more. From the ground upwards, we really need to improve nature. So it's not just as simply what you do on top of the land, it's looking after the whole of it.
That's Mike Pratt, the Chief Executive of the Northumberland Wildlife Trust. Now, all this week, our sister programme, Farming Today, has been looking at farming policy north of the border and the new Scottish Agriculture Act. The Act became law 6 months ago, but farmers say they still don't know how big the budget will be or what support they'll get. Since Brexit, each of the four UK nations have been responsible for their own farming policies. Under the old EU Common Agricultural Policy, farmers got direct payments based on the amount of land they had. Well, in England, that's all changing. Money will now only be paid for public goods, things like improving soil and planting hedges. And Wales and Northern Ireland are still finalising their plans. In Scotland, farmers will still get direct payments, but with conditions attached. BBC Scotland's Environment, Energy and Rural Affairs correspondent Kevin Keane has been telling Charlotte Smith what farmers north of the border can expect.
Unlike in England and Wales, there was a commitment by the Scottish Government, a long-standing commitment, to maintain some degree of basic payments for food production. And that's because there's perceived to be a different landscape here in terms of the agricultural landscape. So much more livestock in farming here, much less arable land, and much more of the less favoured area land, of course, in our uphill areas. But there will be more conditionality attached to them. So farmers will have to do more for the environment to receive those payments. And it's the level of that conditionality attached to those basic payments that has been causing some degree of concern.
Is it clear yet how much those basic payments will be, how much funding will go into them, and indeed, as you say, what you have to do to get them?
Yeah, so you can measure that in two ways. One is the total pot and one is the percentage of the pot, which will be conditional. So in terms of the total pot, no, we still don't have any clear idea, but it is starting to become clearer on the percentages. So obviously this has been the subject to perhaps the most contention during the lead up to the bill going through the Scottish Parliament. So environmental groups had been lobbying hard for just 20% of that funding to be for half on farm support direct payments and for a full 80% of it to be used to fund environmental measures. The farming lobby, they wanted the opposite. They wanted 80% for direct payments. And in the end, the Rural Affairs Secretary for Scotland, Mary Goujon, confirmed that more or less the farmers were going to get what they wanted. 70% of the total pot would be for direct payments, but those payments would be conditional and that conditionality would be enhanced on what exists. That is the commitment for now, although it is still unclear how big, as I say, that total pot will be, even for just next year alone.
Because in the budget, the Scottish Government got more money overall, but the agriculture budget hasn't been ring-fenced, and there is some concern about that, isn't there?
Yeah, indeed. And I would say that this is the biggest issue for farmers at the moment in Scotland. They've been really hammering the point for many years, actually, that they have to have their business planned out over several years for things like crop rotations, of course, livestock management, and they really need some degree of certainty. And that's really what they've had under the EU cap system with their kind of multi-year funding deals that were agreed. They've been calling for that kind of multi-year financial framework to be part of the new system, but that's just not been a commitment that the Scottish Government has been willing to make. And all of their concerns now have been borne out with the latest UK government budget. Then if you Scotland saying that was the first budget where agricultural funding for Scotland was not ring-fenced. Instead, the Scottish Government is being given that money as part of its block grant, its total money for everything that it covers that's devolved. And of course, that means that funding now is competing with other things like education, health, new hospitals, many other pressures being put on that. And there is a big fear about how much of that money will be left over for agricultural support just next year alone. What farming unions now are saying, though, is that they want the Scottish Government, now that it is in their hands to decide, now that it's essentially fully devolved, there's no ring fencing of that cash, they want the Scottish Government now to commit to some kind of 5-year funding framework, and that, they say, would give them the certainty that for years now they said that they have needed.
Well, as Kevin Keane explained there, farmers still have little detail about what they're going to need to do to get the 30% of funding that will go towards improving the environment. It was the talk of the NFU Scotland Autumn Conference in Edinburgh, as Richard Baines reports.
We have sought early engagement with the UK government to work towards a reset in that relationship.
Scottish Agriculture Minister Jim Fairley struck an optimistic note here at the NFU Scotland Autumn Conference.
I must admit, so far, the reception has been miles better than it has been in the previous government.
NFU Scotland was also positive, in their case, about the Scottish Government's new Agriculture Act.
The Agriculture Act is absolutely what we wanted in many, many ways.
Johnny Hall is the union's policy director.
Within that Act, there are the powers to deliver the right sort of support to enable farmers and crofters in Scotland to deliver on food, climate and biodiversity, as well as underpinning rural communities. It's now about turning that primary legislation into something meaningful in terms of delivery on the ground.
But that detail of delivery on the ground is what concerned farmers at the conference, especially the Act's emphasis on environmental protection. Jen Stewart and her family farm near St Andrews in Fife.
There will appear to be support being provided going forward, but the concern is that food security is not perhaps going to be as much of a priority as the environmental side.
Alex Ritchie farms in Perthshire.
We don't know enough to know the exact impact it's going to have yet. We're already doing a lot for improving biodiversity on the farm, so we're hoping that we're prepared for it. But again, until we know more, we won't know exactly what impact it'll have.
The chair of the NFUS Next Generation Committee is 28-year-old Ben McClymont.
There's a lack of confidence and clarity as to what will our sort of future support network look like in Scotland. It's difficult to try and encourage confidence in younger people to go to a more environmentally linked payment system. Then that concerns me, because not everybody will be able to undertake the measures in which may well be needed.
There seems to be this idea that if you've no grazing animals and you've got no economic activity, you've got this wonderful flora and fauna.
In the Highlands, there's been a lot of pressure because of environmental concerns. Ian Wilson is the union's manager for the region.
The reality is, once the grazing animals are removed, you quickly get taken over by non-desired species of plants.
Ian worries that some of the Act's terms around green issues are ill-defined.
Regenerative seems to be a new word. The first assumption for something to regenerate is that it's really broken, when an awful lot of cases it's a small tweak we're needing to improve things, and too much of those people thinking about regenerative and what they're targeting is actually going to knacker the thing, because they're going too far one way without realising the total consequences.
That report from Richard Baines. So still some uncertainty around the new Act. I put that to Scotland's Secretary for Rural Affairs, Marie Goujon.
We're in the middle of our budget discussions at the moment and having those discussions with my Cabinet colleagues and with the Cabinet Secretary for Finance as well. And I think what is important, though, is to point out that we've tried to provide that stability for our farmers and crofters as much as possible, and we'll continue to support them going forward.
OK, so you can't tell us how much farming is going to get then in that case. Can you give us a bit of a ballpark figure?
It's not possible for me to set that out in this period in time. Obviously, we've had £620 million previously. That's been baselined into the budget for this year. And again, we're going through the budget discussions and we haven't yet published our budget. So I'm not in a position to set out what that's going to be.
And in future, to get support payments, farmers are going to have to complete what's called a whole farm plan. We've been hearing from a farmer who says it's just going to be impractical. And it's frankly also a little bit patronising, because many farmers will already have business and environmental plans in place.
You're absolutely right, but I think it's important to look at where this proposal came from. So it's all based on the recommendations of the farmer-led groups that had convened a few years ago. And I believe it was from the Arable group that the whole farm plan had come from. Now, I appreciate many people will already have undertaken many of the audits that we're asking for, and as you've said, may well have business plans in place. And we're not looking to add to that burden. But for those who haven't started that journey, we want to encourage that.
What's the timescale? When are the new schemes going to be introduced?
Again, as I've said, we've set out the conditions to support that will apply from next year, and then we'll be phasing in the other elements of the new framework of support. We don't have the full details of all future schemes in place, but the schemes that we do have in place at the moment will continue until such time as they merge into the new framework. But critical to all of this process, though, is that we want to work with our farmers and crofters, because we want to make sure that whatever policy we introduce does actually work on the ground. I think the journey we're on in Scotland, it has taken a bit longer because of that work that we're doing with our industry, and because we want to make sure we get it right. But I do think that it's worth that in the long term.
That's Marie Goujon, Scotland's Secretary for Rural Affairs. Now, 2.5 weeks on from the budget, and the new agriculture inheritance tax proposed by Chancellor Rachel Reeves is still right up the news agenda. And with farmer protests planned for next week, this is a story that is not going away. To recap, farmers have been exempt from paying inheritance tax so that family farms just pass down the generations. That exemption is being scrapped for farms worth over £1 million, though with other existing exemptions, the Treasury says it'll be more like £3 million. To say this has got farmers angry would be an understatement. This was Welsh sheep farmer Gareth Wynne-Jones on Radio 4's World at One this week.
My father has never felt so angry and frustrated. And I think a lot of us have, because, you know, Keir Starmer went to the NFU conference and said he was going to, you know, watch after the family farms. My family's been on this farm for 375 years. I could be the last generation. Do you imagine how that makes me feel? It's heartbreaking, not for me, but for my children, for my father. Three generations are on this farm working, and I could be the last one.
Well, that is Gareth Wynne-Jones. You know, we always like to hear from you, and we've had lots of emails about this. Our producer, Rebecca Rooney, has been reading through just a few of them.
Yes, Peter Naylor says, our country's run by city slickers mainly, who haven't got the remotest idea of anything which goes on in the farming community. He says, there's a world of difference between farms and ordinary citizens' inheritance, whose premises nearly always have to be sold anyway for the various offspring beneficiaries. Surin Arul writes, he's not a farmer, but he is confused about a lot of the inheritance tax debate. He says, we regularly interview farmers who say their children don't want to follow parents into farming, and other young people who say it's ruinously expensive to buy into a farm. He says surely the only reason farmland's so expensive is that speculators are buying it up as tax avoidance, and without this perk, the cost of land would fall and become more reasonable. Dave Plunkett, on the other hand, says farmers are whinging about not wanting to pay inheritance tax, but at the same time demanding support for any work to improve the environment. He says we should ask farmers where do they think the money for grants comes from, because it comes from taxation. But Barbara Morgan, who says the tax is disastrous for farmers, is all in favour of them being militant. We public must stand by them, she says.
Many thanks, Rebecca. Please do get in touch if you want to share your thoughts on anything you hear on the programme. You can email us at farming.today@bbc.co.uk. Well, the new inheritance tax for farms comes into effect in April 2026, which does not leave long for older farmers to get their affairs in order to pass on the business. It seems DEFRA had asked the Treasury to include some kind of upper age limit for farmers, and the department was only told about the tax changes the night before the budget. Nick Watt, the political editor of Newsnight, broke that story, and he told me why DEFRA ministers might be feeling frustrated and just a tad unhappy.
So they know that there can't be a U-turn, but what DEFRA were hoping that you could soften the edges. And what they were particularly keen on, and as I understand it, they felt they were having good discussions with the Chancellor, who was taking them seriously, not giving anything away, was that you would deal with this issue of older farmers and who would be caught by this. So obviously the current system is no farm has inheritance tax. The new system from April 2026 is any farm worth over £1 million would attract that tax at a lower rate, an effective rate of 20%. And the point is, in any issue of inheritance, if you plan your affairs carefully, then if you gift something and you die 7 years after you've gifted it, then there's no inheritance tax at all. Farmers haven't had to bother to plan for that because until now, until April 2026, there's no inheritance tax. And what DEFRA was saying is surely we could have a system that farmers that are older, farmers in their 80s, we could maybe have some sort of exemption from them, because it could be too late for them to make that sort of classic 7 year tax planning. This is going to come into effect in a year and a half. No time for those coming towards the end of their lives to make that sort of planning. And they thought that the Treasury was listening to it, taking it carefully. But the very clear message I got when I looked into this from the Treasury was no change, no mitigations. And the point in Whitehall is that when the Treasury sort of stamps its authority down like that, then every department has no choice. They fall into line.
As we know, there are major protests by farmers planned for next week, including some farmers saying that they're going to stop supplying food to the shops. How much political welly, if you'll excuse the pun, do the farmers have?
Well, traditionally in this country, the farmers have not had the sort of impact that they would have in France. And then you're thinking of Belgium, Brussels. You know, in France, you will get direct action from farmers. They will close motorways. They will close the centre of Paris. And farmers from all across the northern European Union will bring the centre of Brussels to a standstill. I've been there when they're protesting. We do not have that tradition of direct action in that French and Belgian way. But what I have picked up from government is that they are worried that this could become totemic. It could become totemic in rural Britain. Labour doesn't understand us. Labour's out of touch. Labour is the party of urban Britain. There is a concern in some government circles that that is how this could end up.
Newsnight's Nick Watt. Well, a DEFRA spokesperson told us, with public services crumbling and a £22 billion fiscal hole inherited from the previous government, we have made the difficult decision to reform agricultural property relief in a balanced and fair way. All ministers support the policy and it will not change. OK, if all this talk of tax and politics makes you just want to get away from it all, how about moving to Sark in the Channel Isles? Population, just 600. Cars are banned, though, not tractors. And there's breathtaking scenery and fabulous beaches everywhere you look. Well, there's a dairy farm on Sark with just 15 cows, and they need a farmer to take over supplying milk and cheese to islanders. Jason and Catherine Salisbury have run the dairy for 5 years, but they want to return to their own farm in Suffolk. They've been speaking about the role to BBC Channel Islands reporter Olivia Fraser.
We first asked to come over. It was really the idea of setting up the dairy here on Sark and started up from scratch and whatever. And we feel now we've accomplished that mission. And now it's time to pass it over to the next generation, the next person who wants to do it.
You know, it's sad to go, but we need to go home to our family farm as well in Suffolk. So it's time for a change.
Yeah, it's been a fantastic opportunity for us. And, you know, and we have put Sark milk and butter and cheese. In fact, double award-winning cheeses have gone on to Sark now. And we're really excited and proud that exactly what we've accomplished.
So with Sark Dairy's current tenants leaving, the trustee and the island's senior, Christopher Beaumont, is hoping they can attract the next set of dairy farmers to step into their wellies.
So we need them in by the summer, which means that we really need to have a very good idea of who's going to come late spring. There will be a buy-in cost, and I think that's going to be around £70,000, and that will buy all the processing equipment that the Salisburys currently own and all the cows that they own, so that the new farmer can just take over and just start milking.
What's expected from a dairy farmer on such a small island, though?
To make the whole business function with a good profit margin, they need to be producing and selling 100 litres of milk a day. And if that includes products such as cream or butter or cheese or ice creams or yogurts, then so much the better.
People might be thinking, Sark is so small, why does it need its own dairy farmers? Why is it important that somebody does take this over?
Well, I think Sark, as a small jurisdiction, wants to be as independent as it can possibly be. So having a self-sustaining business for the dairy industry makes absolute sense. I would wish to have as little imported to the island as you can possibly get. So having everything made locally makes absolute sense to me.
So if you've got the qualifications and you're keen for a quiet life, maybe this one's for you.
It's obviously very different. It can be quite isolating in the winter, but it's a wonderful life. I mean, it's lovely. You can get a lovely work-life balance here. You know, the beaches are wonderful, so you can, you know, explore them every day. So there's a lot of lovely opportunities for the right person to come along and enjoy island life.
Catherine Salisbury ending that report. And that's it from us for today. I'm Kaz Graham. The producer is Sally Challoner. And Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production. Have a great weekend.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4. And Simon King's here to update us on what feels like some slightly parkier weather this weekend. Simon.
Parkier, that is definitely one word for it, Lisa. Yeah, thank you. We've got the colder air moving its way in gradually through today, but it means that tomorrow all of us across the UK will see the colder Arctic air in place and bringing us a very different feel to the weather. Just to give you one example, yesterday in Aberdeen, temperatures got to 16.5 degrees Celsius. Today, 7, maybe 8 degrees at best. So just that sign of colder air moving in. But for many parts of England and Wales, it's quite cloudy this morning. We've got some rain, some drizzle. So for southern England, through Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, that cloud with some patches of rain, some drizzle, which will turn a little bit heavier for a time during the morning across North Wales and the North Midlands, and then later a bit further southward, with maximum temperatures getting to about 9 to 12 degrees. Across all of northern England, that cloud with some patchy rain and drizzle will gradually clear to the south, and there'll be some brighter skies developing during this afternoon. So some sunshine to come here for a time, temperatures 8 to 12 Celsius. For Northern Ireland today, sunny spells expected, staying largely dry, but one or two showers around the coasts of the north and the east of Northern Ireland, and highs of 9 to 10 degrees, but it will feel colder as the afternoon goes on. And across Scotland today, already that cold air starting to move its way in, a bit of cloud this morning. That'll break up. There'll be some sunny spells developing. Some showers, though, coming into northern and western areas on a rather brisk northwesterly wind. We'll see some gales in the far north. These showers will turn increasingly wintry as we head into the evening with some snow over higher ground and top temperatures of 5 to 8 degrees. But through tonight, cloud and rain and drizzle will move further south, clearing from the south. And then during Sunday, for many of us, a brighter day with some sunshine. Cloud increasing, though, for Northern Ireland through western areas of England and Wales. Later on, there'll be some rain starting to move its way in here as well. But with a rather brisk northwesterly wind, that colder air for all of us. Again, winter showers with some snow over the higher ground of Scotland.
Thanks, Simon. The Today programme with Amol Rajan and Katia Adler is next here on Radio 4. But first, a look to later this morning. He's back and he's fully stocked.
Join me, Jay Rayner, as I open the doors on a new series of The Kitchen Cabinet. I've assembled an expert panel to answer all your food and cooking questions.
Do you want Thai spicy or English spicy? And I said, I'll have Thai spicy, please. She put in about 6 or 7 of these teeny tiny little green chilies and it nearly blew my head off.
We're taking The Kitchen Cabinet to Wolverhampton, Hitchin and Dorchester. Plus, we're starting with a special episode celebrating World Children's Day.
My question is, favourite pasta, with sauce or without sauce?
What's the best burger you have ever had?
The Kitchen Cabinet with me, Jay Rayner, is on Saturday mornings at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Hello, it's 7 o'clock on Saturday the 16th of November. This is Today with Katia Adler in London and Amol Rajan in Salford.
President Zelensky has criticised the German Chancellor for phoning Vladimir Putin to discuss the war in Ukraine. We'll hear from inside Ukraine, Germany and Russia. And a senior economic advisor to Donald Trump has told this programme that Britain should align itself with the US rather than the EU if it wants a free trade deal with Washington.
The UK really has to choose between the Europe economic model of more socialism and the US model, which is more based on a free enterprise system.
Also in today's programme, nearly 30 years ago, this iconic structure here in Salford made history.
Completed at a modest cost of £3.5 million, it was described as a dynamic, modern and sophisticated exercise in steel, glass and concrete.
The first ever winner of the Best New British Building Prize is now facing demolition. What does that tell us about the shelf life of modern buildings?
Good morning, I'm Dalith Lloyd with your Saturday Sports. Scotland end their 10-match winless run with victory over Croatia in the Nations League.
The BBC News is read this morning by Lisa Costello.
Ukraine's president has criticised a decision by the German Chancellor to speak to President Putin for the first time in almost 2 years. Volodymyr Zelensky said the telephone call had opened a Pandora's box and he accused Olaf Scholz of weakening the isolation of the Russian leader. Germany says Mr. Scholz condemned Russian airstrikes in Ukraine and urged Mr. Putin to end the war with Kyiv. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports from Moscow.
In a post on social media, Chancellor Scholz wrote that he'd called on President Putin to end the Russian war of aggression against Ukraine and to withdraw troops, adding that Russia must show willingness to negotiate with Ukraine to achieve a just and lasting peace. The Kremlin reported that President Putin had made it clear that any peace deal would need to address Russia's security concerns, as well as what it called the new territorial realities, a reference to Ukrainian land that Russia has seized. In Kyiv, President Zelensky said that the Chancellor's decision to call the Kremlin opens a Pandora's box by undermining efforts to isolate President Putin. But such efforts have had minimal success. Last month, Putin hosted the leaders of China, India, Brazil, South Africa and other world leaders at the BRICS summit. And this month, America elected a president, Donald Trump, who speaks not of isolating Putin, but of negotiating with him.
A senior economic advisor to Donald Trump has urged the UK to align itself with the United States on trade rather than pursue closer ties with what he called the socialist model of the European Union. Stephen Moore suggested the US would be less interested in a free trade deal with Britain if the government put its economic relations with Brussels ahead of those with Washington. The governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, has urged the government to rebuild trade relations with the EU. In an interview for this programme, Mr. Moore said ministers faced a clear choice.
The UK is kind of caught in the middle of these two forms of economic model. And I believe that Britain would be better off moving towards more of the American model of economic freedom. And if that were the case, I think it would spur the Trump administration's willingness to do the free trade agreement with the UK.
And you can hear the full interview with Stephen Moore just after 7:30. Police in Essex have defended their investigation into a social media post by the Daily Telegraph columnist Alison Pearson after she said she was left dumbstruck by a visit to her home by officers. Ms. Pearson said she was told they were making inquiries about a non-crime hate incident, but the force has denied that. Will Vernon reports.
Alison Pearson said police visited her home last Sunday and informed her she was being investigated for alleged incitement of racial hatred after a complaint about a social media post from a year ago. The columnist said officers told her she'd been accused of a non-crime hate incident. That's when someone reports hostility they believe is based on race, religion or identity. But Essex Police has now denied telling Ms. Pearson that. The force said at no stage during the interaction with officers was she informed that the complaint was being treated as such, and that police body cam footage proved that. To suggest otherwise, they said, was inaccurate and misleading. The social media post at the centre of the investigation includes an image of police officers standing next to men who are described as Jew haters. The Telegraph says Ms. Pearson deleted the post after it was pointed out that the photo showed police with supporters of a Pakistani political party and was unrelated to the Middle East.
A former Conservative MP has spoken of his guilt and shame at giving colleagues' phone numbers to someone who'd used a fake profile on a dating site. In his first broadcast interview, William Bragg said he'd since suffered panic attacks and even considered ending his life. He was talking to our political investigations correspondent, Joe Pike.
William Bragg said he was lonely and looking for love when he messaged a man on the gay dating app Grindr. He didn't know that the name the man used, Charlie, and his pictures were fake. They spoke on the phone a few times and exchanged naked images. Charlie later asked Mr. Bragg, then a Conservative MP, to send him the phone numbers of some of his colleagues. He said he complied partly because he felt threatened.
He said, "You've got a minute or 2 minutes or something to send me these numbers." And that's when it, as far as I was concerned, turned a bit weird.
Critics would say you made the situation potentially a lot worse and you drew other people into all of this and potentially made them victims as well.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that is why I felt the guilt. That's why I felt so sorry and shameful.
William Bragg, who already struggled with his mental health, had stopped taking his antidepressants and started to feel suicidal. His mother took him to hospital. He was one of dozens of men, mostly working in politics, who were targeted with flirtatious messages. In June, police arrested a member of the Labour Party in his mid-20s on suspicion of harassment and offences under the Online Safety Act. He has been bailed until late November.
The family of the black civil rights leader Malcolm X are suing American law enforcement agencies for $100 million, accusing them of involvement in his killing in 1965. They claim the CIA, the FBI and the New York Police Department were aware of a plot to assassinate him but did nothing to stop it. Here's our North America correspondent, Rowan Bridge.
Malcolm X was one of the most compelling and controversial figures of the US civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. He was famous for suggesting black people should use any means necessary in order to secure their rights. A prominent member of the black nationalist group, the Nation of Islam, he later broke with them, angering some members and drawing death threats. He was killed in 1965 as he spoke at a ballroom in New York in front of several hundred people. The lawsuit alleges the New York Police Department, coordinating with federal law enforcement, arrested Malcolm X's security staff days before the assassination. It also claims federal agencies had undercover agents in the ballroom who failed to protect him from the assassination plot. Three men were convicted over his death, but two were exonerated more than 50 years later when the case was re-examined.
The average fixed rate on a two-year mortgage deal is rising despite the Bank of England cutting the base rate earlier this month. Lenders have been reacting to expectations that future base rate reductions won't happen as quickly as previously thought. Here's our cost of living correspondent, Kevin Peachey.
More than 8 in 10 mortgage borrowers have fixed-rate home loans. The interest rate stays the same until the deal expires, usually after 2 or 5 years. Each year until 2027, about 800,000 mortgage holders currently paying a rate of 3% or less will see their fixed-rate deals come to an end. Seeing the Bank of England cut interest rates just over a week ago would have given them confidence of falling borrowing costs. But market expectations, partly following the budget, have meant lenders are instead upping the rates on new deals. The financial information service Moneyfacts says the average rate on a two-year deal has hit 5.5% this weekend.
The former world heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson has lost his controversial bout against the YouTuber Jake Paul by a unanimous points decision. Tyson, who's 58, last fought professionally in 2005, and the contest in Texas overnight against an opponent 31 years younger has been widely criticised by fans for making a mockery of the sport. Ireland's Katie Taylor retained her undisputed light welterweight title with a points win against the Puerto Rican Amanda Serrano.
Thanks, Lisa. It's 9 minutes past seven. As we've been hearing in the news, Ukraine's President Zelensky has criticised Germany's Chancellor Scholz for making a call last night to Vladimir Putin. Mr. Zelensky fears this could lead to calls between the Russian president and other Western leaders, ending attempts to isolate him. There are reports, of course, that Mr. Putin has already spoken to Donald Trump since his victory in the US elections.
Chancellor Scholz told me that he was going to call Putin. Olaf's call, in my opinion, is a Pandora's box. Now there may be other conversations, other calls, just a lot of words. And this is exactly what Putin has long wanted. It is extremely important for him to weaken his isolation, the isolation of Russia, and conduct talks as ordinary talks.
Chancellor Scholz is a beleaguered figure, to put it mildly. He's led a really unstable coalition government and he now faces a snap general election in February, which he doesn't even think he's going to win. Well, earlier I spoke to Oleksiy Gocharenko. He's a Ukrainian MP and a member of the Ukrainian delegation to the Council of Europe. I asked him if he understood why Olaf Scholz decided to call Vladimir Putin. It's a move that's been criticised by a number of Western diplomats too.
I understand President Zelensky, and I want to be clear, nobody in Ukraine likes to see Putin being hugged by another leader, so being spoken with them or anything like this. We want to see him in a hug in the courts as a war criminal who he is. At the same time, we absolutely understand, me personally, I understand Donald Trump is clear that he wants to make a deal with Putin. And other leaders will speak with him when he controls Russia. So he still controls Russia, unfortunately.
And so do you feel that this call then was actually for domestic consumption, for German voters heading to an election? And if that's the case, isn't that quite a dangerous roll of the dice? Because it does end a sense of isolationism in Europe towards President Putin.
Again, I just don't want to intervene in German internal politics. And yes, there will be snap elections. Yes, Olaf Scholz is fighting for his position and for some re-election. But I think this call was organized in cooperation with other G7 countries. Probably, I hope, there was a message, important message, that Putin shouldn't on the fact that like the West is tired and all this blah, blah, blah. So if it was the case, then it's okay. Then everything else, which how it could be used in internal German politics or anything else, I'm not interested in this.
We've heard from our Russia editor, the BBC's Russia editor, that the Kremlin is delighted about the call with Olaf Scholz that was requested by the Germans. Do you worry now that Donald Trump is coming back to the White House? We've heard President Zelensky say that is going to speed up the end of the war in Ukraine. Under what conditions could that be? And do you worry that European resolve is slipping too as a result of the US election?
We know what Donald Trump said about 24 hours, that he will finish the war. We don't know how exactly he is going to do this. I also believe that Donald Trump wants to have Ukraine as a victory. He loves victories. And he doesn't want to have his own Afghanistan like Biden had in the beginning of his term. does the victory for Trump mean the same, which it means for us? Do we have the same definition? That's the question, and we don't know for the moment.
Do you trust your European allies that they are as steadfast as they say they are?
That's a very important question. We trust our partners, but we think that our partners are doing not enough, not just for Ukraine, but for themselves. All the fact that Europeans were following U.S. elections more than elections in their own countries, I mean, it shows it's ridiculous and it's a shame. Europe shouldn't be so much dependent from what's going on in another side of ocean from another country. So Europe should make lessons, being strong enough, and in this case, they will not be so dependent, and Ukraine can be a very important part of this European security.
Hasn't it been obvious since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine? I mean, Germany is the second largest supplier of military aid to Ukraine, as of course you know, but it's still way, way behind the United States. If the United States under Donald Trump turns away and says no more military aid or a lot less military aid, whatever the Europeans say, it doesn't look good for Ukraine.
Absolutely. The United States is absolutely vital. Life of Ukraine. But one more concern that under Olaf Scholz, at least, Germany was always following the United States. So if United States were providing Ukraine with tanks, okay, then we will provide you with tanks. And all the time like this. So there was no leadership from Germany. And in general, there is a lack of European leadership in what's going on. And I hope that Germany will change its attitude, will show more leadership, not just Germany, France in general, European Union, because that's what we need. And also, as the United Kingdom, you have new prime minister, and in 2022, UK prime minister was the one who showed leadership, and United Kingdom was leading other nations in their efforts against Putin. I hope very much that, especially Donald Trump, the vision of what is going on will be very dangerous for Ukraine and for security in Europe. I hope very much that United Kingdom can lead again, can speak with Americans, can explain them why it is so important. So we rely very much on UK leadership in the next months.
Oleksiy Gocharenko, thank you very much indeed.
It is 7:15. Let's take you through some of the other stories in the papers and on the news websites this morning. Plenty of coverage of these so-called non-crime hate incidents following the police visit to the house of Alison Pearson, a Telegraph columnist. That's on the front of the Daily Mail. Thought police in Starmer's Britain like Soviet Union, warns Boris Johnson, their columnist. There's also a picture of Davina McCall, the TV presenter who has had an operation and is out of surgery after a benign brain tumour was found yesterday. In The Times, there's a very interesting sort of preview of a big story to watch out this coming week, which will be all over, which is the growing rural revolt, particularly over changes to inheritance tax. And as The Times notes this morning, there'll be two separate sort of marches or efforts on London. On Tuesday, there's going to be a union-endorsed set of lobbying chats with MPs across Westminster, and then another organised march through the streets. But the piece of the morning that really struck out for me was a very thorough analysis of why the Democrats lost in the US by John Byrne Murdoch, the FT data journalist. And it's absolutely definitive, really, with lots and lots of data. The reason the Democrats lost is because they embraced social and cultural issues rather than focusing on economics. So he writes, the data shows Democrats taking a sharp turn leftward on social issues over the past decade. This has distanced them from the median voter. He also goes on to say, US voters also perceive the Democrats as having moved much further left than the Republicans have shifted right in recent years. And these shifts, layered on top of rising education polarization, are changing the image of the Democratic Party in voters' minds. It used to be seen as the party that stood up for the working class and the poor. In 2016, that flipped. Now it's seen primarily as the party of minority advocacy.
And that's a taste of the newspapers this morning. It is coming up to 7:18, and it's the end of the first full week of Donald Trump's presidential transition period. And what a week it's been. As he announces his pick for the top table, those he's nominating to join him for his next administration, political allies and foes at home and abroad have been frantically trying to keep up, to interpret, to guess the direction of travel of one of the world's most unpredictable leaders, where he's planning
planning to take the world's biggest economy. Jess Parker is our North America correspondent. She's in West Palm Beach at the Conservative Political Action Conference. That's an annual political conference which is attended by conservative activists and elected officials from across the US. I asked her first about Donald Trump's latest nomination, that's of his press secretary. If 27-year-old Carolyn Leavitt is confirmed, she will be the youngest person to hold the role ever.
Caroline Leavitt, who's been a spokesperson for the Trump transition and had a more junior role in his last administration, like you say, just 27 years old, so she'd be the youngest press secretary in history, and the person who I guess will become a very familiar face. One of the most visible roles in an administration in the White House stands behind that famous lectern, fielding questions from reporters, and not just speaking to the media, but for, on behalf of the president. And I was watching an interview she was doing on Fox News, where she said that Donald Trump had been making fantastic picks for her at his top team. And I think, given that it will now be her job to offer robust support for Donald Trump, perhaps not surprising that she was saying that in an interview.
Do you think that when we approach Donald Trump's picks, that we're doing it in the wrong way? We're taking it at face value. Whereas actually, we know Donald Trump is a disruptor, a provoker, and a tester of loyalty as well. Because, of course, all these, you know, picks have to go before the Senate. And he'll see how senators, Republican senators, support or not his picks. So do you think we should be looking at other motives rather than just a straight, this is who I want for the job?
I mean, I think the theme of loyalty has probably been the dominant one all week. And that stretches, as you say, across lots of different areas. So promoting people or offering people jobs who have shown him loyalty, even if there are big questions about their suitability for the role, their experience for these important roles as well. And you mentioned the word disruption. That's another word I hear as well, used quite positively amongst conservative Republican supporters that I've been speaking to. They want, they say, people who'll disrupt governments, disrupt institutions in Washington, D.C. But of course, what that means is it may be a bit of a disruptive process to actually get them confirmed. And then to return to that theme of loyalty, as you say, looking at the Senate, which after the election is going to be Republican controlled, Donald Trump is absolutely potentially testing the loyalty of those senators and to what extent they will allow his nominations to pass through and to what extent they may challenge those nominations as well.
Jess Parker, thank you.
The time now is 21 minutes past seven and time for Yesterday in Parliament. To Westminster we go because that's where a Labour peer has called for the resentencing of prisoners being held without a set release date. Yesterday in Parliament, Lord Woodley described indeterminate sentences as a scandal. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Alicia McCarthy.
Imprisonment for public protection was introduced in England and Wales by the last Labour government. It meant some prisoners were given a minimum tariff, but could be held for much longer until they were ruled not to be a risk. IPPs, as they're known, were abolished in 2012, but the change wasn't retrospective, and around 2,700 inmates are still being held, either because they've never been released or because they've been recalled to prison. A Labour peer, Lord Woodley, wants them and other IPP prisoners who've been released but are still on licence to be resentenced. He had this warning for the government.
Don't wait for the ITV docudrama to cast you unfairly as uncaring, cold-hearted time wasters who left damaged people, many of them broken by the state, to rot away in prison while those in power stood by, wringing their hands.
A Conservative barrister and former Justice Minister, Lord Garnier, accepted there would be practical and political risks for the government and an additional burden on the courts in having to resentence those in jail or out on licence. But
saying it's all too difficult and we can improve things only at a risk-averse glacial pace is unacceptable, inhumane and uncivilised.
A Liberal Democrat, Lady Ludford, wondered,
what is this government going to do? Keep these nearly 3,000 imprisoned people locked up arbitrarily and indefinitely, just like in Guantanamo. And that's not hyperbole. Are they going to become any less dangerous or challenging by getting more and more embittered, angry, hopeless and mentally ill as a result of their outrageous continued confinement?
Labour's Lord Blunkett was Home Secretary when IPP sentences were brought in under the Criminal Justice Act 2003.
I carry my responsibility heavily. I hope that sometimes the judges themselves will think about why they didn't see IPP as part of a menu.
The Conservative Shadow Attorney General for England and Wales, Lord Wilson of Tredegar, told Piers to be clear-eyed.
There is sometimes a tendency to assume that those people who received an IPP sentence did little more than steal a Mars bar and were just unlucky to get an IPP sentence, rather than a traditional determinate sentence.
When in fact, he said, the original trial judge must have concluded there was a significant risk of serious harm in future, including murder or rape. For the government, the Justice Minister, Lord Timpson, argued decisions on safe release should be made by the parole board. And under Lord Woodley's bill, it wouldn't play that critical role.
Legislating to give every IPP prisoner a definite release date and post-release licence, or legislating to provide for resentencing by court, would result in them being released automatically. This would be the case even where the parole board have previously determined, and in many cases repeatedly, that they continue to be too dangerous to be released, and they have failed to meet the statutory release test.
Piers gave the bill their initial support, but without the government's backing, it won't become law.
And the time is coming up to 25 minutes past seven. The stories of Ireland's notorious Magdalen laundries are playing out on the big screen, in small things like these with Cillian Murphy, but also on stage. Survivors of institutions for unmarried mothers in Northern Ireland are telling their stories through a touring play and exhibition. They hope it'll encourage more people to come forward to an inquiry investigating allegations of forced adoption and other abuses. Our Ireland correspondent Chris Page reports, starting with Marianne Hotel, a play written by a survivor.
Where did they take her? Surely you can't just come into the hospital and take someone's baby and walk out without their permission?
Aye, they can. That's what they do. Did you just never wonder why the Orgairds come back to Marianville on their own after giving birth? Lying on their beds at night pretend they sleep. They are breaking their hearts, for God's sake, kitty.
Stories which were once silenced by stigma are now on stage.
Ave, ave.
Promise me, Sinead, that you know that I want what's best for this baby. But I am so scared, Sinead. I'm so scared of giving birth. I'm scared of the pain of it. And I'm looking at Sarah and she's so sick.
The play is set inside Marianville in Newry, one of the institutions for unmarried mothers in Northern Ireland during the last century. The writer is a survivor of the system.
Everything was geared towards having your baby adopted. There was no mention of keeping your baby, no encouragement. We were told not to talk to each other or tell each other about ourselves.
Katrina Cunningham based the lead character, Kitty, on herself. She gave birth to a daughter in 1980.
I got my daughter back when she was 3 months old. I'm very lucky, one of the few lucky people. But for years I didn't tell anybody that I was a Marianville. In recent years it just was on my mind all the time. I was thinking of other women. I started just to put down wee notes about it. This is what's it's come to now.
What about her fella? What about her fella? Maybe her fella could come and speak to me.
He'd be some help, all right.
I thought he was mad about her. They're never off the phone.
He stopped ringing her weeks ago.
God.
She's been trying to ring him, but nobody will answer the family phone. He doesn't want to know.
The company behind the play is Sole Purpose Productions. The artistic director, Patricia Byrne, explains that trauma support workers are at every performance.
They will be there to, you know, to give wellbeing support to anyone that might be impacted or might be feeling emotional about what they see. You know, they will also have their information leaflets there. And it's very much kind of a call to people that have been impacted by mother and baby homes to come forward.
Here at Linen Hall Library in Belfast, memories are also being explored in visual form in what's called the Sunflower Project. A film of women talking about life in the institutions is being shown beside original artworks by survivors and artefacts in display cases. There's the poignant sight of baby shoes. Katrina's christening gown and the rosary beads she was given when she left Marion Vale. Survivors hope that the more stories that are told, the less power that shame and secrecy will have over people's lives. The issues are currently prominent in the cinema too. Cillian Murphy is the star of the film Small Things Like These, which is about a Magdalen laundry in the Republic of Ireland in the 1980s.
Don't you ever question it?
There's hope that people who remember anything about the institutions in Northern Ireland, such as Neighbours, might tell what they know. An independent panel is gathering testimonies confidentially to feed into an upcoming public inquiry set up by the devolved government in Belfast. The co-chair, Professor Leanne McCormick, says evidence is emerging that some private nursing homes may have been used to hide mothers and babies.
We can see some of this in records, but particularly from people's experience, and that's something where we would really ask for if somebody had that experience of giving birth in a private nursing home, that they would come forward and tell us that, because it's trying to fit together the pieces of all of these stories.
So scared.
You are a strong woman. You are.
Survivors say they want the truth to be fully known, and creative expressions are playing a powerful part in bringing the past into the light.
Chris Page reporting there. And now at 29 minutes past seven, with me here in Salford, it's Delith Lloyd. Hi, Delith.
Good to be alongside you, Amal. Yeah. John McGinn came off the bench to score and hand Scotland their first Nations League win against 10-man Croatia last night. The 1-0 victory at Hampden was much needed after 10 competitive games without victory. Northern Ireland beat Belarus 2-0 at Windsor Park. England's netballers face Jamaica in the New Horizons series this weekend, with today and tomorrow's matches taking place in Manchester. I've been speaking to the former England captain Serena Kirsten, formerly Serena Guthrie, and she told me the Red Roses are in a good place at the moment.
I think they're certainly flying high, you know. Don't get me wrong, I think they'll obviously be disappointed that they couldn't steal another game of the Aussies, but I think it's been really pleasing to see the consistency of their performances, and the fact that they've been building and getting better and better only just sets them up for what's going to be, I think, quite an incredible couple of days up in Manchester.
And England and Jamaica ranked second and fourth in the world respectively. A lot of these matches between these two sides are relatively close. England, of course, beat Jamaica not so long ago in the Fast Five World Series, but there isn't much between these two, is there?
No, not really. And to be honest with you, there's not much between first and fourth anyway now. You know, like it's incredible that recently we've just been bumped up to number two in the world, which is great. But, you know, world netball it's tight. The talent up in those kind of top four teams is just incredible at the moment. So, yeah, don't let the rankings fool you. That's for sure. It's going to be a really close weekend.
Yeah, you mentioned being back up to seconds in the world. You've jumped above New Zealand. Do rankings matter then to players, or do they not take them as seriously as other people do?
Oh, everybody loves the bragging rights, don't they? You know, so I don't think it's something that it's just taken with a pinch of salt. It takes a lot of work to get yourself back up there in the rankings, particularly in those kind of first and second positions. But at the end of the day, when you're out on court, I think there's an awareness now that anything can happen.
Tell me about the England goal attack, Lewis Pearson.
Oh, well, what a talent she is, right? I mean, she just came in there, no caps, first game against Australia. It just blew everybody out of the water. I'm not sure anyone really expected to see that from somebody obviously so new into the game, but, I mean, what a level of maturity she's shown, and I think everyone's looking forward to seeing what she's going to do over this weekend against another top three team.
Yeah, the upward trajectory continues, doesn't it, under head coach Jess Thirlby. How far away, though, are England from getting the top spot in the world rankings and for regularly beating Australia, do you feel?
Yeah, I think we're definitely moving closer. I think the Australian Test Series was, evident that we are making steps towards that. But at the end of the day, you've got to be able to go and do it on the day, no matter what's happened in your four-year calendar in the big competition. So I think that's something that England is still building towards, that consistency of performance to be able to put out, top-flight performances against an opposition like Australia. But we just seen what happened to Australia and New Zealand as well when they went 3-0 and, New Zealand won the Constellation Cup, what was that, kind of 3-0 before Australia came and answered. So you just don't know what's going to happen. You know, these oppositions these days and the tactics and what the coaches are doing with their players in terms of the people they want to get out on court to give themselves that experience. But then also, you know, find your next Lois Pearsons as well. So it's tight, but, you know, we are moving forward and it's really pleasing. And I think, you know, today or this weekend, the crowds and the people who are, you know, bums on seats coming to watch the Roses is really evident that people are quite excited to see what's to come next from this team.
Former England captain Serena Kirsten and England-Jamaica is on the BBC iPlayer from 3:45 this afternoon.
Thanks, Daleth. With news of tomorrow's edition of Broadcasting House, here's Paddy O'Connell.
Hello. We'll go down on the farm ahead of next week's planned protests over inheritance tax. His is one of the most famous voices on the airwaves. So how does it sound to us like he's been copied by artificial intelligence?
Donald Trump has nominated Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz as the next Attorney General. Gaetz, a staunch ally of Trump, was previously the subject of a federal investigation.
We meet Robert Icke, the star playwright behind the reworked Greek tragedy Oedipus, and a big freeze is predicted this weekend. We conduct a nationwide search for brass monkeys. BH is on BBC Sounds and here on Radio 4 from 9 tomorrow morning.
Look forward to that. Thank you very much indeed, Paddy. Today will be cloudy across England and Wales with a band of patchy light rain gradually sinking southeastwards. Northern areas will have bright spells and scattered showers.
It's coming up to 35 minutes past seven. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amal Rajan in Salford and Katia Adler in London. Summary of the news now from Lisa Costello.
Ukraine has reacted angrily after the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz spoke on the phone to Vladimir Putin for the first time in almost 2 years. President Zelensky said the call had opened a Pandora's box by weakening the isolation of the Russian leader. Mr. Scholz said he urged the Russian leader to begin talks with Kiev to achieve a just peace. A senior economic adviser to Donald Trump, Stephen Moore, has urged the UK to align itself with the United States on trade rather than pursue closer ties with what he called the socialist model of the European Union. Mr. Moore suggested the US would be less interested in a free trade deal with Britain if the government put its economic relations with Brussels ahead of those with Washington. Police in Essex have defended their investigation into a social media post by the Daily Telegraph columnist Alison Pearson after she said she was left dumbstruck by a visit to her home by officers. The force said it was investigating an allegation of incitement to racial hatred following a complaint from a member of the public. Ms. Pearson said she was told police were making inquiries about a non-crime hate incident, but the force has denied that. A former Conservative MP has spoken of his guilt at giving colleagues' phone numbers to someone who had used a fake profile on a dating site. William Ragg started messaging the man earlier this year and said he complied with the man's requests partly because he felt threatened. He said he'd since suffered panic attacks and even considered ending his life. Almost 60 years after his death, the family of Malcolm X are suing US law enforcement agencies for $100 million, saying they knew of a plot to kill the Black Rights leader but failed to stop it. They've accused the FBI, the CIA and New York police of complicity in the murder in 1965. The average fixed rate on a 2-year mortgage deal has risen to 5.5%, despite the Bank of England cutting the base rate earlier this month. Lenders have been reacting to expectations that future base rate reductions won't happen as quickly as previously thought.
Thank you, Lisa. It is coming up to 37 minutes past seven. Britain should align itself with the United States on trade rather than pursuing close ties with the EU. That's according to Stephen Moore. He's a senior economic advisor to Donald Trump and he's just been with him at Mar-a-Lago. That's Donald Trump's beach resort. It's also home to his presidential transition. There's a constant stream of serious contenders for top posts in his next administration coming and going to the club these days. Now back in Washington, I asked Stephen Moore why he thinks the UK has to choose between the US and EU. Labour grandee Peter Mandelson, whose name is prominently linked to the UK's possible picks to be the next ambassador to the US, says the UK should aim to have its cake and eat it.
The UK really has to choose between the Europe economic model of more socialism and the US model, which is more based on a free enterprise system. And I think the UK is kind of caught in the middle of these two forms of an economic model. And I believe that Britain would be better off moving towards more of the American model of economic freedom. And if that were the case, I think it would spur, you know, the Trump administration's willingness to do the free trade agreement with the UK. I think it would make sense for both Britain and the United States.
I'm interested in your definitions, Mr. Moore. I mean, here in the United Kingdom, we have a prime minister, Sir Keir Starmer, who describes himself as a socialist, but also as a progressive. His government is interested in free trade, and the European Union is a big free trading power, actually, on the world stage. As far as the UK is concerned, is Donald Trump really open to a US-UK free trade deal? Because last time round, and the last time that he was in the White House, there was little significant progress made.
Well, I think some of the economists who Trump has selected to be part of his team are in favor of that, and some of them are not. So I think that will be an internal debate within the new White House. And so I can't answer your question affirmatively one way or the other, because I think that is yet to be determined.
The last time that negotiations faltered, it was particularly over UK concerns over agricultural standards. So allowing hormone-treated beef from the United States or chlorine-washed chicken from the United States into the UK market. Would food standards have to be on the table in a trade negotiation?
I think we have the best agricultural standards in the world, so I wouldn't see that as a problem from this side of the ocean. But I do understand that in Britain, I know the last time I was in London, that was a big issue with many of the British folks I talked to. So I think the problem has been greatly exaggerated, but we'll see how this all turns out.
I suppose what I'm asking is this a bottom line? Because the UK Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has ruled out again allowing chlorine-washed chicken, for example, onto the UK market. From the US point of view, is that a deal breaker? And another question, what about the health service, the National Health Service in the UK? Would access to that also needs to be on the table?
I think that those are details that would have to be worked out. I would hope that we could maybe find a way around those two problems, but I can't really definitively say right now. You know, Donald Trump is just reelected. This is important to us, but it's not the single most important issue right now for Donald Trump. I know he's concentrated on the two or three big things, including, you know, making sure that we get inflation down and the illegal immigration problem. Those are by far the most important issues for the American voters. By the way, Trump has talked a lot about tariffs generally, especially against China and some of the European countries. So I think he'll probably start with using tariffs as a negotiating tactic.
Indeed. I mean, he has said, hasn't he, Mr. Moore, that for him, tariff is the most beautiful word in the dictionary. I guess what the UK is hoping is that since the UK is not necessarily his focus, it is more big beasts, China, the EU as a trading bloc, as far as tariffs are concerned, that the UK might be able to get a carve out from those tariffs, because Donald Trump did say that there would be sort of a blanket tariff imposed on all imports of 10 to 20%. Could the UK find a carve out, do you think?
Boy, these are tough questions you're asking me, because, again, you know, the entire cabinet still hasn't been picked yet. At this stage, he still hasn't even settled on who his trade negotiator will be. I do think we have a special relationship with Britain. And I think most Americans, I think Donald Trump, you know, view Britain in a very different way than certainly from China or other countries that we view in a more adversarial way.
If the UK did not impose retaliatory tariffs, as the EU has already said it will, would that be a deal for the deal maker, for example?
There's two issues. There's one about tariffs against countries that impose high tariffs on us. So Trump has a word that he uses often, which is reciprocity. And that is, if other countries are going to impose high tariffs on the United States, we're going to impose high tariffs on them. And Trump has made that very clear. And again, he uses the word reciprocity to describe that. Now, there's another issue, though, and that is, he has talked about an across-the-board tariff that would be maybe 10% or 15%. We don't know exactly how high that might be. The idea would be to have a tariff on things that are imported in the United States, which is a tax, and then lower taxes on things that are produced here in the United States. And that happens to be a fairly popular position with many American voters. And so those are the two kind of trade issues, and they're very distinct from one another.
Absolutely. It's just those blanket tariffs on imports would cost the UK very dearly to its economy. So, of course, the hope here would be to be able to organise a carve out, an exemption for the United Kingdom in that case.
So, for example, we have, as you know, we have a US-Mexico and Canada trade deal. And so it's certainly possible with this uniform tariff that he's talked about, that because of our special relationship with our North American neighbors, that we might exempt them. And so your question is, might we exempt Britain? Maybe. I don't know the answer to that.
Stephen Moore, thank you very much indeed for your time.
It is 17 minutes to 8. It was back in 1996 that here in Salford, they were celebrating the very first winner of the Royal Institute of British Architects Stirling Prize, which recognises the best new building in Britain.
It was the simple but innovative design of Salford's centenary building which won the unanimous approval of the panel of judges. Completed at a modest cost of £3.5 million, it was described as a dynamic, modern and sophisticated exercise in steel, glass and concrete.
Well, once upon a time, it was the emblem of the University of Salford, but nearly 30 years later, the centenary building, which is about a mile and a half from where we are in this studio, could be razed to the ground. And there's quite a to-do about whether it should stay as a symbol of our 20th century heritage or go to unleash the economic potential of this buzzing area in West Manchester. Critics say it's too hot in summer, too cold in winter and too noisy, and it's been vacant for around a third of its life. But what does that building and the argument over its future tell us about modern architecture? Can cutting-edge new buildings have a long shelf life? Well, Catherine Croft is the director of the 20th Century Society, which campaigns for outstanding buildings to be saved. And Edwin Heathcote is the architecture and design critic for the Financial Times. Good morning to you both. Catherine, if I could start with you, what do you think makes this building worth keeping?
I think it's a really good example of one of the best buildings of that period of booming university development. I think it was part of the regeneration of Salford. It was designed to encourage students to interact with one another. It had this kind of central street and then seminar and teaching spaces off it. It was just designed to be the kind of heart and soul of the university. And it was built really well on a surprisingly cheap budget, but definitely with the intention of having a pretty long life.
Yeah, £3.5 million doesn't go very far these days compared to maybe back then. Edwin, what's your assessment of it as a work of architecture?
Well, it won the first Stirling Prize, so it's been kind of, I guess you could say, formally assessed as an important building. I don't think it's a great work of architecture, but I do think that in this age, we should be looking to preserve buildings, especially kind of decent quality buildings, as much as we can rather than demolish them. And if they can be adapted, then all the better. And I don't see any reason why something like this couldn't be adapted. It might need to change. It's important to remember, I think, that a building is not something you finish. It's not an event. It's a process. It always needs to adapt and change. And I think this is the perfect example of something that just needs a little intelligence applied to it.
And is it, Edwin, sometimes the kiss of death for a building to be seen as contemporary? Because the point about being contemporary is at some point, contemporary things are no longer contemporary. They necessarily become out of date quite quickly. And this was of its time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, modern architecture is 100 and something years old now. It really isn't that modern anymore. And you know, architects like to imagine that they're immune to fashion, that they're building for all time. But of course, you know, like everything else, these things are dictated by fashion. And you can tell when you look at this building, it looks like a thing of its era.
It really does. Catherine, how could and should it be repurposed, do you think, and preserved for the modern age?
It's an area that is being redeveloped and there's a lot of pressure for new housing. But you can't just have housing on its own. If we're going to build proper places for people to live, then we need things like nurseries and GPs, surgeries, lots of other sort of social facilities. And this building would be really well suited to housing some of those.
But there are lots of people here who think the better thing to do is to say, look, it is a white elephant. It stood empty for a third of its life. Knock it down and use that precious land for something else which people really need.
We don't need to do that. And there's a huge amount of embodied carbon energy in that building, which it would be just squandered if you were to knock it down and then use more carbon to build a new building on the site. Plus, it does have a history and it encapsulates people's memories and stories of the way that Salford's changed over the years. So I think you get a much richer end result if you can keep the building and incorporate it into the future of the area.
OK, Catherine Croft, Director of the 20th Century Society, and Edwin Heathcote from the Financial Times. Thank you both very much indeed.
It's coming up to 49 minutes past seven and it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Reverend Roy Jenkins, Baptist minister in Cardiff.
Good morning. Dismay, shock, fury. Just a few of the headline words which have greeted Donald Trump's appointments to key positions this week. They're the more polite ones. A lawyer who served in the White House during his first presidency described the man who will be Attorney General as simply unqualified, academically, professionally, ethically, morally, and experientially. The person who will be overseeing a vast network, including the CIA, the FBI, and the National Security Agency, is said to have no experience in this area. She'll be Director of National Intelligence, and on it goes. Whatever qualities these and other candidates possess or lack, one appears above all to make them irresistibly attractive to the man in charge: loyalty. They'll be his people, subscribing to his agenda, committed to doing his bidding. From taxation and health care to securing the borders, returning the migrants and shaping international relations, they'll know what he wants and know too that remaining in favour will depend on delivery. After all, 76 million Americans voted for Donald Trump to deliver. No different to many other governments around the world, maybe, whether they see themselves as bastions of democratic freedoms or shameless in their naked tyranny. Whoever's at the top needs to know that those who cluster most closely can be trusted, prizes their loyalty, sometimes above their competence or integrity. And yes, that can happen at much more modest levels: a parish council, parent, teacher association, sports club, church, sometimes absurdly, sometimes tragically. In any place where important decisions are being made, a key question is always, who will speak truth to power, offer the alternative view, point out when necessary that the emperor has no clothes? Some of my greatest heroes have been those who've done exactly that, and their successors around the world today who too often languish behind bars because they've refused to stay silent. Their concern for truth and justice has overruled fears for their own safety. For religious believers, the primary loyalty is meant to be to God. The conviction is that the one who gives us life, sustains that life, and sets out its purpose deserves a faithful response in the way we treat the world and everyone in it. For Christians in particular, that offers in Jesus a model of love, service and sacrifice, and a relationship which extends way beyond the limits of time and space. As for other loyalties, to family, friends, community, country, well, they all have their place, of course, but none can be absolute. The love that asks no questions can too easily be a cop-out. Speaking truth to power can be dangerous, but ultimately it reveals a deeper loyalty.
And that was Thought for the Day with Reverend Roy Jenkins, Baptist minister in Cardiff.
Time now is 9 minutes to 8. What is a non-crime hate incident, an NCHI. Essex police have defended their visit to the home of Alison Pearson, a Daily Telegraph columnist, over a social media post, a visit which Miss Pearson said left her dumbstruck. Essex police said that at no stage did its officers tell Miss Pearson the investigation was related to a non-crime hate incident. They say they went to a residential address to arrange a time to do an interview with a woman about a complaint made by a member of the public. But the saga has prompted interest in these NCHIs. The Times reported this week that 13,200 NCHIs, these non-crime hate incidents, were recorded by 45 police forces in the 12 months to June this year. Among those visited by police are schoolchildren, doctors, vicars and social workers. Let's try and make sense of what this story is really all about. With, first of all, Damien Grammaticus, our political correspondent. Damien, morning. Just tell us what these NCHIs are, Damien, and also what the political row is about. So what have Kemi Badenoch and the government said should be done?
Morning, Amal. So an NCHI has been around for about a decade. It's where somebody can report something to the police they think is motivated by hostility towards a group or person. The police then can only record sort of your data alongside that if they think there is clear hostility there, but it doesn't quite arise to the level of a criminal offence. Now, Kemi Badenoch, a leader of the opposition, has said in a first interview with a newspaper, with the Telegraph, that you shouldn't have journalists getting visited by police for expressing opinions and the laws that this need to be looked at. What the government has said is that the police are operationally independent. They should spend their time dealing on matters that are most important to people, but that it is important that they're able to capture data relating to this sort of thing because that is useful to have in future. Now, I think it's worth saying, though, one thing that this incident, I mean, it's not so much a political row, but there is questions of the police and the reporting of it. There are questions about that, or we should be aware of, in that the Alison Pearson and the reporting said that it was about a non-crime hate incident. Essex police have actually said it's an investigation under Section 17 of the Public Order Act, which means a possible criminal matter relating to inciting racial hatred linked to a post on social media. And they themselves have made a complaint to the press regulator about what they say is false reporting about the ongoing investigation. So it's kind of a tricky area, but one, as you say, politicians are wading into.
Okay, Damien Grammaticus, our political correspondent. Thank you very much indeed. Good to talk to you, Damien. Let's turn to Donna Jones, Conservative Police and Crime Commissioner for Hampshire and the Isle of Wight, former chair of the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners. Donna, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I think given the complexity that Damien was talking about there, let's talk about this in sort of general terms, if you like. Do you think there's anything worthwhile at all about these NCHIs?
Yes, I do. But I think that it has to radically change. And the events of the last week have really brought this to the head, which is, I think, in some ways quite helpful. And so I think it's important that the police are capturing people, community tensions or hate crimes as they are reported. And if they determine that they are a non-hate crime, that information should be collected. And I think the Home Office should be monitoring it. It can give indications of where you've got, issues rising in certain communities. However, where I don't agree with the current law and the process, and by the way, a lot of the police are very frustrated about this as well, is that if it is a non-crime, it should stop there. Yes, collect the data, feed it into the Home Office that someone has reported, that someone has done something that's offended them. But if the police determine it's not a crime, it's not a hate crime, then they should not be going and knocking on someone's door and encouraging them to come in for a voluntary interview or undertaking some kind of enhanced thinking course.
Is collecting data or interviewing people about hate incidents a good use of police time?
Well, I mean, again, that is actually a very good point. Let's take the riots and the, you know, lots of protests we had over the summer, post those tragedies in Stockport. And what we did see was a spike in certain parts of the country, around hate crimes. Now that does actually help the police to be able to plan ahead with, riot policing and what level of response they think that they need to put in. For the Home Office, it's useful for them to be able to decide if they need to be putting more money or more preventative programs into certain areas. areas, working with local authorities around the Prevent programme and things such as that. So I suppose, yes, it is using police time to even record it on a police system if it's not a crime. I do get the point you're making there. But really, for me, the review that's being undertaken now by the Home Office, supported by Number 10, and particularly factoring in Kemi Badenoch's comments yesterday, my position has been for the last two or three days that the police should not be going to somebody's home if they've not committed a crime.
And what do you think smart reform of them might look like?
Well, that's it. The guidance needs to be very much clearer. It's grey, it's opaque at the moment. Police forces will deal with these things in different ways, and that's not helpful in itself. So clearer guidance that if it's not a crime, the police might capture the data if the Home Office still want it to be captured and fed in, but they don't have to respond to it. And when the police go to someone's address, hypothetically, and say, we're inviting you in for a voluntary interview, when they come in, they have a conversation, and at the individual's costs, as I say, the police often encourage them to do some kind of, non-hate crime enhanced thinking course. That has brought so much scrutiny, which is why Suella Braverman, when she was Home Secretary, reviewed this and really pulled back on those courses being pushed to people. So there are some things that do need to happen, changes moving forward.
And we've got some of your ideas for those there. Donna Jones, Conservative Police and Crime Commissioner for Hampshire and the Isle of Wight. Thank you very much indeed.
It is Thursday, the 7th of September, 1978. I am walking across Waterloo Bridge in central London, and I am about to be murdered with a poison-tipped umbrella.
Brand new drama starring Simon McBurney and Christopher Eccleston.
You come here and presume to lecture me about the truth.
Inspired by real events, the life and death of Georgi Markov.
It is, not to put too fine a point on it, a warning from history.
Breaking the Rules, The Markov File, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, this afternoon at 3.
The weather now with Simon King.
Katya, thanks indeed. Good morning. We've got some changes on the way for the next few days. Colder Arctic air spreading in from the north. Now, this morning it's quite cloudy. We've got some outbreaks of rain, some drizzle for some parts of England and Wales. So let's start off in southern England, Wales, Midlands, eastern England with the cloud, the drizzle and that rain, which could turn a bit heavier for a time across parts of North Wales, the North Midlands and then further south later on. Temperatures getting to about 9 to 12 degrees. For northern England, it's cloudy. Again, some rain, some drizzle. That's going to gradually move southward and clear away. There'll be some brighter spells developing later on, highs of about 8 to 12 Celsius. And for Northern Ireland, sunny spells today, staying largely dry, temperatures of 9 to 10. And across Scotland, sunny spells, but quite windy with gales in the far north. Some showers also coming in, which will turn wintry as the day goes on. Snow over the higher ground of Scotland and temperatures of 5 to 8 Celsius.
Thanks, Simon. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Katya Adler.
The headlines this morning. President Zelensky has accused the German Chancellor of opening a Pandora's box by phoning Vladimir Putin to discuss the war in Ukraine. We'll hear more from our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, after the news. An advisor to Donald Trump has told this programme that Britain should align itself with the US rather than the EU if it wants a free trade deal with Washington.
The UK really has to choose between the Europe economic model of more socialism and the US model, which is more based on a free enterprise system.
And police have defended their investigation into a social media post by the Daily Telegraph columnist Alison Pearson.
And coming up in the next hour...
The noise is deafening in the striking dome-shaped venue, home to the Dallas Cowboys NFL side. It's a real pro Mike Tyson crowd, those fueled by nostalgia, keen to see if the old-timer has still got it.
Well, those fans were disappointed because the 58-year-old boxer Mike Tyson lost to a YouTuber half his age. But what does the fight, which was streamed live on Netflix, tell us about the future of TV?
Good morning, I'm Delith Lloyd with your Saturday Sport. And after two narrow defeats in the Autumn Internationals, England welcome world champion South Africa to Twickenham.
The BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
Ukraine's president has criticised a decision by the German Chancellor to speak to President Putin for the first time in almost 2 years. Volodymyr Zelensky said the telephone call had opened a Pandora's box, and he accused Olaf Scholz of weakening the isolation of the Russian leader. Germany says Mr. Scholz condemned Russian airstrikes in Ukraine and urged Mr. Putin to end the war with Kyiv. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports from Moscow.
In a post on social media, Chancellor Scholz wrote that he'd called on President Putin to end the Russian war of aggression against Ukraine and to withdraw troops, adding that Russia must show willingness to negotiate with Ukraine to achieve a just and lasting peace. The Kremlin reported that President Putin had made it clear that any peace deal would need to address Russia's security concerns, as well as what it called the new territorial realities, a reference to Ukrainian land that Russia has seized. In Kyiv, President Zelensky said that the Chancellor's decision to call the Kremlin opens a Pandora's box by undermining efforts to isolate President Putin. But such efforts have had minimal success. Last month, Putin hosted the leaders of China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and other world leaders at the BRICS summit. And this month, America elected a president, Donald Trump, who speaks not of isolating Putin, but of negotiating with him.
A senior economic adviser to Donald Trump has urged the UK to align itself with the United States on trade rather than pursue closer ties with what he called the socialist model of the European Union. Stephen Moore suggested the US would be less interested in a free trade deal with Britain if the government put its economic relations with Brussels ahead of those with Washington. The governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, has urged the government to rebuild trade relations with the EU. Mr. Moore told us ministers faced a clear choice.
The UK is kind of caught in the middle of these two forms of economic model. And I believe that Britain would be better off moving towards more of the American model of economic freedom. And if that were the case, I think it would spur the Trump administration's willingness to do the free trade agreement with the UK.
Donald Trump has named his election campaign spokeswoman, Caroline Leavitt, as his White House press secretary. At 27, she'll be the youngest person to ever hold the role. Police in Essex have defended their investigation into a social media post by the Daily Telegraph columnist Alison Pearson after she said she was left dumbstruck by a visit to her home by officers. Ms. Pearson said she was told they were making inquiries about a non-crime hate incident, but the force has denied that. Will Vernon reports.
Alison Pearson said police visited her home last Sunday and informed her she was being investigated for alleged incitement of racial hatred after a complaint about a social media post from a year ago. The columnist said officers told her she'd been accused of a non-crime hate incident. That's when someone reports hostility they believe is based on race, religion or identity. But Essex Police has now denied telling Ms. Pearson that. The force said at no stage during the interaction with officers was she informed that the complaint was being treated as such, and that police body cam footage proved that. To suggest otherwise, they said, was inaccurate and misleading. The social media post at the centre of the investigation includes an image of police officers standing next to men who are described as Jew haters. The Telegraph says Ms. Pearson deleted the post after it was pointed out that the photo showed police with supporters of a Pakistani political party and was unrelated to the Middle East.
A former Conservative MP has spoken of his guilt and shame at giving colleagues' phone numbers to someone who had used a fake profile on a dating site. In his first broadcast interview, William Ragg said he'd since suffered panic attacks and even considered ending his life. He was talking to our political investigations correspondent, Joe Pike.
William Ragg said he was lonely and looking for love when he messaged a man on the gay dating app Grindr. He didn't know that the name the man used, Charlie, and his pictures were fake. They spoke on the phone a few times and exchanged naked images. Charlie later asked Mr. Ragg, then a Conservative MP, to send him the phone numbers of some of his colleagues. He said he complied partly because he felt threatened.
He said, "You've got a minute or 2 minutes or something to send me these numbers." And that's when it, as far as I was concerned, turned a bit weird.
Critics would say you made the situation potentially a lot worse and you drew other people into all of this and potentially made them victims as well.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that is why I felt the guilt. That's why I felt so sorry and shameful.
William Ragg, who already struggled with his mental health, had stopped taking his antidepressants and started to feel suicidal. His mother took him to hospital. He was one of dozens of men, mostly working in politics, who were targeted with flirtatious messages. In June, police arrested a member of the Labour Party in his mid-20s on suspicion of harassment and offences under the Online Safety Act. He has been bailed until late November.
The family of the black civil rights leader Malcolm X are suing American law enforcement agencies for $100 million, accusing them of involvement in his killing in 1965. They claim the CIA, the FBI and the New York Police Department were aware of a plot to assassinate him but did nothing to stop it. Spain's finance minister, Carlos Cuerpo, has said deadly floods in his country 2 weeks ago were undoubtedly connected to climate change. 224 people died, most of them in the Valencia region. Mr. Cuerpo was speaking to our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
The number of people confirmed dead after the recent flooding in eastern Spain is still rising. The economic impact has been huge, Carlos Cuerpo told the BBC, saying he would allocate whatever it took for recovery efforts. Asked about the blame game between ministers in Madrid and the regional Valencian government, he acknowledged that many in the local community remained furious about the lack of timely warnings.
You can understand the anger. Of course, they are suffering, as I said, loss of lives. More than 200 lives have been lost. There's still missing people, so it's very understandable.
Mr. Cuerpo said rising temperatures in the Mediterranean had helped change the pattern and timing of high-altitude isolated depressions, known in Spain as DANAS. It was connected to climate change, he said, and was a warning of the urgency of fighting global warming.
There's been a big increase in the number of people receiving help with their water bills through social tariffs. 1.6 million households in England and Wales had their bills reduced in such a way last year, an increase of 250,000 on the year before. But newly released data shows the amount of help on offer varies widely depending on where people live. Here's Dan Whitworth from Radio 4's Moneybox.
The average bill reduction for households on social tariffs offered by one water company is as high as £287 off an annual bill. At the other end of the table, it's less than half that, £110. Eligibility for this help varies too. Depending on your supplier, it can include things like if you're on benefits, your overall income, and if you have any savings. The Consumer Council for Water says this wide variation in the help on offer is why it wants to see social tariffs standardised across England and Wales. Water UK, which represents the industry, says the government sets guidance on social tariffs and water companies offer significantly higher reductions than other utility providers.
The former world heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson has lost his controversial bout against the YouTuber Jake Paul by a unanimous points decision. Tyson, who's 58, last fought professionally in 2005, and the contest in Texas overnight against an opponent 31 years younger has been widely criticised by fans for making a mockery of the sport. The BBC's boxing expert Steve Bunce says it was a huge anticlimax.
It was 100% about the money. There was no, I want to test myself against the new generation. There was no, I just want to see if I've got this left. There was no, I need this on my mental health. No, it was, I need this in my bank account. I got 31 million guaranteed. It was purely a financial transaction.
Earlier, Ireland's Katie Taylor retained her undisputed light welterweight title with a points win against the Puerto Rican Amanda Serrano.
Thank you, Lisa. It is just gone 8:10. Why did the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz pick up the phone yesterday to Vladimir Putin? It was the first call between the two men in over 2 years. It's common knowledge that Ukraine is in trouble. Its soldiers on the back foot along their front lines with Russia. Kyiv so concerned about Donald Trump's election victory as well. Donald Trump is known to admire, or at least to have admired, strongman leader Putin. He's boasted he could end the war in Ukraine in a day, but he hasn't explicitly said he would want Ukraine to win. So, strong European support is all the more important to Ukraine. And its President Volodymyr Zelensky clearly thought the Scholz-Putin call, which the Kremlin said came at Germany's request, was a terrible idea.
Chancellor Scholz told me that he was going to call Putin. Olaf's call, in my opinion, is a Pandora's box. Now there may be other conversations, other calls, and this is exactly what Putin has long wanted.
Well, our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, joins me now on the line. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning to you.
Is this what Russia has wanted? I mean, what does the Kremlin feel about being approached by the German Chancellor for the call? Perhaps we can all guess.
Well, of course. I mean, there's a very positive reaction here in Moscow. The story was running pretty high up in the running order in last night's evening news on Russian television. Reporting here in Russia has stressed that it was Germany that called Russia, not the other way round. And it's also stressed that the Kremlin's position hasn't changed an inch. It mentions that Vladimir Putin referred Chancellor Scholz to Putin's so-called peace proposal of June, which actually read more like an ultimatum to Kiev, because under that plan, Ukraine would have to withdraw from all four Ukrainian territories to which Russia lays claim, plus recognise Crimea as Russian, plus ditch plans to join NATO, plus Western sanctions would be scrapped. But basically, I think this call cements the Kremlin's claim that attempts to isolate Russia have failed. It makes the Kremlin more confident. And so you can understand the reaction in Ukraine, this sort of, hang on, what on earth are you doing picking up the phone calling Putin reaction. A lot of concern that will just embolden Vladimir Putin.
Embolden Vladimir Putin, and also concerns in Ukraine. There must be about a weakening of European ranks at a time when Kyiv worries about Donald Trump's re-election, his return to the White House, and Olaf Scholz, the biggest economy in Europe, picking up the phone to Vladimir Putin.
Yes, absolutely. I think the timing is really interesting here for a couple of reasons. I mean, you could argue that this call is a sign of the new world we're in, right? Post-US election. We know that Donald Trump and his team have expressed skepticism about continuing US military assistance for Kyiv. We know that Trump has said he wants this war over as soon as possible. And we know that he's expressed very little public criticism of Putin over the war. And so Chancellor Scholz picking up the phone, calling the Kremlin, may reflect recognition by some European leaders that the new US administration is likely to push hard for a peace deal, even if that requires Ukraine to cede territory, and that Europe wants to be in on the negotiations. I mean, there are some reports to suggest that Germany coordinated this call with its G7 colleagues. But I think timing's important for another reason too. And now we're talking about domestic German politics, because in Germany, right, the governing coalition recently fell apart. There's going to be an election, a federal election in February. We know that populist parties in Germany on the far right and the far left are against continuing military assistance for Ukraine. They're demanding negotiations with Russia. And sort of styling himself as the Chancellor of Peace, if you like, willing to talk to Putin, helps Chancellor Scholz steal their thunder and kind of set himself apart from his main rival from the CDU, Friedrich Merz, who said, yeah,
That might be his hope. Well, let's go to Germany now, Steve, to Tobias Bachelet, who's a member of the German Foreign Affairs Committee and a Green MP. The Greens are one of the three parties in the country's coalition government, which, as Steve was saying, is facing a snap election in February. Good morning, Herr Bachelet.
Good morning.
In your opinion, was Chancellor Scholz right to make this call to Vladimir Putin yesterday?
I would say making a call in general is not wrong, but the timing is, I would not say interesting. Let's be honest, it was rather weird, because talking to each other, that's important, but not talking to each other for 2 years, then losing your majority in the parliament, facing, as you already said, snap elections. We are just left with two of the three parties in the government, and we're actually facing election campaigns, or we already started to have them. And now picking up the phone, that's not really a good timing. And above all, there's not a clear...
Perhaps Olaf Scholz thought it was good timing for him domestically, at least. He does sell himself as a so-called, or at least the people around him, a peace chancellor, but he's been criticised. Germany, of course, is the second largest donor of military aid to Ukraine after the United States. So even if it didn't achieve anything in concrete terms, I mean, he called on Vladimir Putin to withdraw his troops from Ukraine, et cetera, he must have known Vladimir Putin wasn't going to say, okay, no problem. But maybe this was really for domestic consumption.
Yeah, but sorry, Ukraine, and there's too much at stake. And also, when we look at it purely from a German or European election, there's too much at stake. The priority number one needs to be a strong position to negotiate for Ukraine. And we only achieve that with a strong commitment. So now, having that call without making publicly clear that Ukraine needs to be in that position of strength to actually have a chance for a peace talk as well. And let's be honest, I mean, what the heck was that peace? Let's not call it peace proposal, please. What Putin probably suggested there, as far as we know there. So I think now timing a call for domestic reasons, for campaigning reasons, this does not fit, or that the huge impact that might have.
Absolutely, Herr Bachelet, but the reason that Germany is now facing a snap election, the Greens are not blameless in this. There's been so much internal bickering that this is why, in the end, Germany faces this situation. We spoke to a Ukrainian MP on this program not long, just, you know, in the last hour, yeah. And he appealed to Germany for leadership. He said Germany has failed in its leadership. Some of that goes on you, the Greens. What should Germany's policy towards Ukraine look like, whatever the makeup of the next government, and perhaps especially because Donald Trump has been re-elected to the White House?
I think the base of our politics and policies about Ukraine needs to be a strong commitment that we are, as I said, want to put Ukraine in a position of strength so they're able to negotiate. This is not only about weapons, but it is about weapons.
Well, they've asked
as
for security
well.
Guarantees before they sit down at a table. They're demanding them. Should they get them? Membership of NATO. Security guarantees is what Kyiv wants.
I believe that, of course, or the other way around, I completely understand that Ukraine needs those security guarantees. Whether it gets them before they sit down to the table or afterwards, I think that's up to debate. But I completely understand that for Ukraine, it is a necessity, and also actually for Europe, that Ukraine has a reason to believe any kind of peace will actually last. And of course, for that, to believe into that, of course, they need security guarantees.
Tobias Bachelet, member of the German Foreign Affairs Committee and Green MP. Thank you. And thank you to Steve Rosenberg in Moscow, too.
It's 19 minutes past 8. Nick will be presenting this programme from the Bulgaria-Turkey border on Monday to look at the impact of illegal migration, one of the biggest issues facing Europe right now. He's there with our producers, Jade Bogart-Prelur and Oscar Pearson, and he sent us this update from Istanbul in Turkey. It's worth saying that for many migrants, Turkey and Istanbul and that border, it's the starting point of their journey deeper into Europe and even to the UK.
When people talk about migrants crossing the channel, they talk of stopping the boats or cracking down on the people smuggling gangs. All too often we talk as if the problem begins in France. But it often begins in places like this, Istanbul in Turkey, a country which threw its arms open to millions of refugees from Syria, but is now beginning to turn its back on those people, harassing and abusing some, arresting them for having the wrong papers and being in the wrong place, and with many facing deportation. The result is that some are forced into the arms of people smugglers, trying to cross the sea to Greece or over a mountainous border to Bulgaria, and then deeper into Europe. I'll be presenting the Today programme from the Bulgaria-Turkey border on Monday morning.
Look forward to that. Should be really, really interesting. The time now is 20 minutes past eight. There was a rather extraordinary sporting contest, if you could call it that, in Dallas this morning, finishing around about 5:30 our time. In it, Mike Tyson, 58 years old, once upon a time the most feared and ferocious heavyweight boxer since Muhammad Ali and maybe Rocky Marciano, was back in the ring for 8 2-minute rounds against a chap called Jake Paul. Jake Paul is 27 and one of the most notorious men on the internet, not to be confused with his brother Logan, another entrepreneur and fellow minted YouTuber, who's also one of the biggest names on the internet. And the BBC's Khal Sajjad was at the AT&T Stadium in Dallas.
70,000 fans have packed out the AT&T Stadium for Mike Tyson versus Jake Paul. The noise is deafening in the striking dome-shaped venue, home to the Dallas Cowboys NFL side. It's a real pro Mike Tyson crowd, those fueled by nostalgia, keen to see if the old-timer has still got it. Jake Paul may have 70 million followers across social media, but there is no doubt who the star attraction is.
Well, sadly for Tyson, he didn't have it. There's a lot of people say he should never have been in the ring. He took a lot of punches to the head without protection. It did end with something of a damp squib. Paul won on points, but in the last 10 seconds, he bowed down in a kind of show of respect to Tyson. One of the fascinating things, though, is the whole fight was streamed live on Netflix, where it was marred by some technical issues. And Adam Kelly is the president of IMG. That's one of the largest sporting marketing agencies in the world. His company works with sports organisations, league clubs and federations, including the Premier League, Wimbledon, as well as UFC for the Ultimate Fighting Championship and WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment. Adam, good morning.
Good morning.
What was it about connecting with an audience that's massive, global and young that first attracted Netflix to this fight, do you think?
It's a very good point. The reality is that sport needs to continue to evolve, and the introduction and engagement from Netflix is really interesting to see how sport can really attract new fans, attract new audiences, and to build in this future whereby the world's biggest technology companies really want to capture the magic and the attention that sport can only drive in its unique way, which is this live, incredible attraction to really drive this appointment viewing.
And it's a drama, isn't it? It's a story because you don't know the ending.
Absolutely. You can sit here after the fact and talk very clearly about the things that were most obvious and were likely to happen in that fight. Tyson to lose, Netflix experiencing some streaming issues, and it being a no contest. But beforehand, the world was captured, fascinated. The man on the street was discussing it, and it really engaged with fans and audiences in a brand new way.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely huge, huge contest and would have aroused a lot of interest. There's something specifically about boxing and fighting, isn't there? Because it sounds a strange thing to say, but in a way, it's a curious fact about boxing or fighting that because they often take place in a small space, often just between two individuals, they're easier to film and therefore more cost effective than, for instance, filming a football match or let alone the Tour de France.
Production cost doesn't normally come into it in that way, but it certainly allows you to focus on that small, tight space, the small arena. But also for the sport, it means there's really nowhere to escape. And I think with boxing and fight sports in general, you do get an honest result almost no matter what. And there is the sense of the gladiatorial aspect of seeing these two incredible athletes, you know, going at it in some ways.
I've spoken to Ted Sarandos, the Netflix boss, about this a few times, and his very smart answer always used to be, when people said, why don't you go into live sport? He'd say, it's not that I'm not interested in live sport. I love live sport. It's just I have to ask, is this the best way to spend my next $10 billion? And he was talking in the context of securing rights for major leagues, which are very, very expensive. This fight's more of a one-off. Why is it, do you think, that Netflix is moving into live sport?
The main reason is that ability to engage with huge live audiences in a way that entertainment content simply cannot deliver. So this year we've seen record ratings for the Olympics, for the Euros, for Copa America, all through the summer. The Super Bowl set, again, a new record rating. We're seeing this interest in live moments really peaking above and beyond everything else and anything else that is out there. So for Netflix, it's only a natural evolution of their business model. They're currently getting close to 300 million subscribers. They're driving a lot of interest into their ad-supported platform. Their latest figures showed they've now got 70 million subscribers on that ad-supported lower-cost platform. And live sport, where you can predict a large peak audience at a particular moment with highly engaging content is perhaps the most interesting to advertisers. So when you look at all of those combinations together, you realize that Netflix, but also the other large technology companies, will be coming for sport in a way that I think is going to be beneficial for sports fans and audiences, because they will be much more effective at driving these monetization models, which hopefully will not be an increase to the fan.
Adam Kelly, president of IMG, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's 26 minutes past eight and time for more sport now with Delith.
Thank you very much, Katia. England will look to put an end to four straight defeats when they face double world champion South Africa at Twickenham this evening. It's a rematch, of course, of last year's World Cup semi-final, which the Springboks won by just a point. Let's speak to the former England scrum half, Matt Dawson. Matt, after a close defeat then to New Zealand and then, of course, last week's final minute loss to Australia, how much will England relish this facing the world champions?
Good morning. Yeah, I think they'll be very, very excited about this because they have had some great moments over the last couple of weeks. Obviously, it's slightly tarnished by having two losses next to those games, but they want to pitch themselves against the best. They're challenging for sure. And you know, having South Africa in your backyard is a monster challenge. But you know, England do have the firepower. They have the expertise. They have their moments. They have Marcus Smith to create some kind of, you know, innovation to beat this enormous box side. So it's going to be an exciting afternoon. Maybe England just need to absorb the pressure a little bit, and we can see a victory.
Steve Borthwick's made four changes to the side, including bringing Freddie Stewart in at fullback. What difference can he make?
Yeah, I think if you do look at both sides, it says to me how they're going to play. Freddie Stewart, Freeman in the backfield, Van Poortvliet at nine. I think there is going to be more of an aerial game, an attacking aerial game. Stewart is, you know, superb in the air, and with the way that the laws have slightly tweaked, I think it will be give him a better opportunity to clean that up. Whereas, actually, if you look at the South African side, it looks like they really want to play. They probably want to have less of a kicking option and run the ball around. So both teams are going to have to adapt. But I think you're going to be disappointed if you're Ben Spencer, who I think has played pretty well over the last couple of weeks, to be dropped out of the squad completely. But that's, you know, that's what happens these days in international sport. You've got to be right on it to be in the team.
South Africa themselves have made 12 changes to the side that won in Scotland a week ago, and they've named five forwards on the bench compared to seven last week, so a 5-3 split between forwards and backs. How much does that tell us, do you think, about what they're expecting as well from England?
Yeah, the South Africans have some squad, that is for sure, to be able to make all of those changes week to week away from home. Usually that would just mess with your continuity, but not with this South African squad. They're very adept to playing different styles of rugby. And I think you're really going to see a fine match between two well-matched sides. And whoever gets the tactics right on the day under the pressure is going to enjoy themselves.
Yes, let's hope it lives up to the hype, Matt. Great to speak to you. Matt Dawson is part of Five Live's commentary team. You can hear it on Five Live, kickoffs at 5:40. Meanwhile, Ireland bounced back from their opening autumn defeat by overcoming Argentina 22-19 in Dublin last night. Wales face Australia in Cardiff tomorrow, in a week which has seen head coach Warren Gatland face more criticism. I've been speaking to the former Wales international and TNT pundit Jamie Roberts. So how does he rate the chances of his old side tomorrow?
They're in a tough place, there's no doubt about that, but you know, I've been part of teams that have gone through this kind of run, and you know, that kind of energy, that desire to win, has got to come from within. It's got to come from within the camp, from within the lads, from the coaching group themselves. And you know, I think they've got a brilliant opportunity this weekend. You know, some people might disagree with me, but when I see Australia and what they did at Twickenham, yeah, it's an incredible win. Got to credit the Wallabies after their I guess they've found a way to come out of their tough period as a group. The challenge for them is can they repeat that kind of arousal level, that energy this weekend in Cardiff? And it's very hard to back it up. If I was that coaching group and player group of Wales now, I'd be thinking exactly that. It's very hard to back up that sort of victory and that kind of high week on week. I think Wales, they showed glimpses against Fiji. And if they can, you know, repeat that quality for 18 minutes, they got a brilliant opportunity this weekend. No doubt about that.
Other headlines this morning. Scotland ended a run of 10 winless games with victory over Croatia in the Nations League. Northern Ireland beat Belarus 2-0. Great Britain are through to the quarterfinals of the Billie Jean King Cup. Ireland's Katie Taylor successfully retained her undisputed light welterweight title in a controversial points win against Amanda Serrano in Texas. All three judges scored the fight 95-94 for Taylor. And your racing tips for today, both at Cheltenham in the 110 number 2 transmission and in the 220 number 13 Il Ridotto.
Taylor, thank you. Nice to share a studio with you. It is 29 minutes to 9 and Saturday Live is at 9 o'clock. Here's Nikki Beddy with more details.
Our Saturday Live guests today have all made their mark on the world in different ways, using different things. One with a stethoscope, actor Martin Clunes as Doc Martin. He's now written a book about remarkable animals. Another with sneakers, the trail runner Sabrina Pace Humphreys. She'll be talking about rural racism, identity and hope. And the other with a sword, actor Richard Armitage, Thorin Oakenshield in The Hobbit. He's turned his talents to writing novels and the audiobook comes first. All that, plus we have the inheritance tracks of comedian Ellie Taylor. If you'd like to be in touch with us, do email saturdaylive@bbc.co.uk and we'll join you just after the news at 9.
Looking forward to that. A look at the weather now. Today will be cloudy across England and Wales with a band of patchy light rain gradually sinking south eastwards. Northern areas will have bright spells and scattered showers.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Katia Adler in London and Amol Rajan in Salford. Here's a summary of the news from Lisa Costello.
The Ukrainian president has reacted angrily after the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz spoke on the phone to Vladimir Putin. Volodymyr Zelensky said the call had opened a Pandora's box, weakening the isolation of the Russian leader. A senior adviser to Donald Trump has urged the UK to align itself with the US on trade rather than pursue closer ties with what he called the socialist model of the EU. Stephen Moore said the US would be less interested in a free trade deal with Britain if the government put its economic relations with Brussels ahead of those with Washington. Police in Essex have defended their investigation into a social media post by the Daily Telegraph columnist Alison Pearson. The force said it was examining an allegation of incitement to racial hatred, and it denied Ms. Pearson's claim that officers told her they were looking into a non-crime hate incident. The former world heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson has lost his controversial bout against the YouTuber Jake Paul. Critics of the fight said it had made a mockery of the sport.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. 26 minutes to 9. The economic numbers out this week offered a mixed picture at best, but on the headline number, growth, it was really thin gruel. Just 0.1% growth in the third quarter of the year. That's down from 0.5% in the second quarter. And we're going to spend the next few minutes on this programme not interrogating why that number was low, but what the rest of Britain can perhaps learn from people here in Manchester, which has been outperforming the national economy with higher growth and employment. And this isn't just about Manchester, it's really about the lessons Manchester may have for a country that has seen nearly two decades of sluggish growth, productivity and real wages. We're joined by three guests, Susanna Cordoba, who's the Head of International Trade at the Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce. With me in the studio, Ian Simpson, founding partner at the architectural firm Simpson Hough, and Lorna Fitzsimons, founder of The Pipeline, an entrepreneur and a member of the Greater Manchester Business Board. She was also Labour MP for Rochdale between 1997 and 2005. Good morning to each of you. Suzanne, if I could start with you, just your overall reaction to the numbers this week. What did it tell us about how the national economy is performing, do you think?
I think definitely a bit of downturn, as been explained. And I think it's, you know, in terms from my point of view, it has to do a lot with what's happening globally and, you know, the recent results with impacting some of that global trade. And generally speaking, most businesses have seen generally a downward in their export sales and their domestic sales and orders as well, according to our most recent quarterly economic survey.
So what did you make then? I don't know if you heard Stephen Moore, a Trump advisor, who's on this program just about an hour ago, Susanna, who said that basically in the battle between the US and the EU, the UK's really got to lean more to the US and the US kind of way of doing economics and commerce and trade if it wants a favourable trade deal. What did you make of that?
Yeah, definitely. The US has become a lot more important for us, especially in terms of our service sector. We've seen a huge boost in our export sales. But however, we also have to consider the fact that with the recent results of the elections in the US, we're going to see maybe a bit of downturn for our export of goods. And that's an important bit for us because at least for Greater Manchester, at least 46 of our exports are in that sector. And the US is either our first or our second largest export market. So I think we're going to see, yes, more leaning towards the US, but we also have to consider that I don't think a trade deal is near or in the horizon for us. And we continue to be very much, in line with Europe in terms of our trade.
Okay.
We continue to be our largest partner.
Well, let me put that trade point to you, Lorna. Just in terms of how you're thinking, Lorna, about the coming changes to trade, potentially with tariffs from America and also our relationship with the EU, what do you think is the outlook for trade in the UK, Lorna?
Throughout time, there have been different political administrations with different approaches, both in America and in Europe. So what business does is business deals with what it's presented with. What we need is confidence and clarity from government. We need investment and we need, obviously, and this is where I think Greater Manchester triumphs, a combination. It's the combined approach of world-class public servants working and trusting business to work together to negotiate the best deals.
But what are the specific things, just before I come to Ian Simpson here in the studio, what are the specific things that Manchester has got going for it which the rest of the country can potentially learn from, Lorna?
It's got the most mature combined architecture of 10 local authorities that decades ago decided that they were going to be stronger together and therefore have got this unrivaled ability to work across local government, national government, business, academia and the voluntary sector. It has got an unrivaled history of delivery. So if you just take one of the biggest punts, and it was a Conservative government who did it, devolving health and care to Greater Manchester, the Harvard Review that has just been published shows it's an overwhelming gain. And that was not at all going to be certain because it's the first time it's done under complexity. So we've got a joined up approach and a mature architecture. We have got a real expertise in delivery and we have an unashamed ambition.
Was that the Harvard Review that Ed Balls was involved in? Sorry, just to clarify.
George Osborne mentioned it at Sir Howard Bernstein's memorial as a testament this week. And actually, one of the things George said was that having somebody like Sir Howard over the last 50 years as a public servant was as important to what Manchester has been able to deliver in terms of growth as having world-class business leaders or anything else.
Yeah, and it's good of you to credit a Conservative from across the political divide. Ian, let me come to you. Before we talk about planning, which is central to the Labour plan, the Labour sort of agenda, what do you think has worked, Ian, in terms of getting Manchester going?
I think what has been suggested is this really strong public and private collaboration. As an architect and people working in that field, we're looking to create a really beautiful city with amazing public spaces, fantastic cultural offer, flexible workspace and great places to live. And what this does is it helps retain and attract highly skilled talent. The city embraces change and investment, and it's all about creating jobs for the residents of Manchester and those who want to move into the city. It's a dynamic city, and we're growing the population from basically 400 people 25 years ago to almost 100,000 now.
There was a very influential paper published a month or two ago called Foundations, Ian, which looked at the building in this country and why building and investment in infrastructure has been so sluggish. What will it take in terms of planning reform? What have you seen of the planning reform that's been announced that will actually get this whole country building again?
I think it's all about confidence. I think the developers and the investors want to know that there's an honesty in going forward, and that there's support for change, and that investment is embraced. There's a really important aspect to that, is that is a focus on quality. But the idea of scale, density, these things need to be accommodated within our cities, because we need more people in order to create demand for hotels, restaurants and so forth. It's about people, and for investment terms, we just need that confidence building.
Okay, Susanna, Ian alluded to it there. What do you think can be done, Susanna, to turn the service industry around?
I think at the moment there is a lot going on in the innovation side. We have, there is a lot of investment, and that's from what the other two speakers have alluded to. Private sector have been investing a lot of innovation, and that's how I think we're going to continue boosting our service sector and those collaborations as well. Not just be private, public, but also with other countries around the world.
Lorna, what's your honest assessment of whether or not what happened before the budget, the amount of time between the election and the budget and that uncertainty was a problem for the UK economy? Don't you think it would have been better to move quickly?
I don't think there's a perfect answer, Amal. You know, there's no in our lifetime, there's no such thing as a perfect budget. I do think that business abhors uncertainty, and that is a truth. And as was said, confidence is key. People like to know whether they agree with what's been done or not. They like knowns, and then they can work around them. Business is very sophisticated and mature. And one of the things the stability of the leadership in Greater Manchester over the last 30 years has delivered is that for business. And that's why Manchester has been an outlier in terms of some of the things that it's been able to achieve. And so my pitch to government would be, as a business person, is trust us. Because where you have trusted us, we've actually stepped up to the plate and delivered time and time and time again. And business working together with high class public servants is absolutely the key to the collaboration. We've just opened a collaboration with Cambridge, the golden triangle, as it were, with the Northern Powerhouse, because of the connectivity and because of our confidence. And we are world-class at innovation, and we just need to make sure that we're making those connections. But stability and confidence with investment are absolutely key.
Okay. Susanna Cordova, Head of International Trade at the Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce. Ian Simpson, founding partner at the architectural firm Simpson Hough, and Lorna Fitzsimons, founder of The Pipeline, former Labour MP. Thank you all very much indeed.
It is coming up to 16 minutes to nine. Europe is worried about Donald Trump, really worried for economic reasons. He's threatened to slap blanket tariffs on all imports, as we've been discussing on the programme. And the US is the EU's biggest trade partner, and it's the biggest single country buyer of UK imports as well. But Europe has big security concerns as well. It looks to the US to have its back on security and defence terms. It has done since the Second World War. But Donald Trump puts America first, and this at a time when the biggest war is raging on European soil since World War II, in Ukraine, of course. Complicating transatlantic relations is also that so many of Europe's leaders have spoken ill or at least dismissively of Mr. Trump over the years, and he's famed for holding grudges. The Labour government has its concerns, and as for the EU, well, it is on the lookout for who could be their Trump whisperer, a bridge to the new administration. Some of the EU's most senior leaders actually came up during the Trump campaign.
Viktor Orban, one of the most respected men, they call him a strong man. He's a tough person. They said, why is the whole world blowing up? 3 years ago, it wasn't. Why is it blowing up? He said, because you need Trump back as president.
Giorgia Meloni is someone that I admire, that has done an incredible job as the The Prime Minister of Italy.
Macron. Do you know Macron? He's a very nice guy. Macron. I said, Emmanuel, how are you? He said, fine. I said, I heard you're going to charge American companies 25% to do things in Mexico. Who else are you doing? Well, nobody yet, but we will do other. I said, no, but you're not going to do it, Emmanuel. You're not going to. No, Donald, it has already passed. I said, well, you better unpass it.
That was Donald Trump talking first about Viktor Orban, Hungary's prime minister, during the TV debate with Kamala Harris. Then we heard Elon Musk praising Italy's prime minister, Giorgia Meloni. And finally, Donald Trump mentioning Emmanuel Macron, imitating Emmanuel Macron, I think was what he was trying to do earlier this year during a speech in Iowa. Well, Amida Van Rij is senior research fellow at Chatham House. She heads up the Europe program and joins me in the studio. Nice to see you.
Good morning.
Good morning. So I spoke about how the EU has got economic concerns and security concerns, but another one is unity, right? Because there is no European unity amongst EU member states in attitudes right now towards Donald Trump.
Yes, absolutely. And that's really the huge concern. I think if we look at the responses and European heads of government's attitudes to Trump, there's probably three buckets. The first bucket is those leaders who are concerned, would have preferred a Harris presidency, but will make do. The second bucket are...
The big bucket that includes the big powers, right?
Yeah.
France and Germany under the current administration, is that?
Germany, Spain, those kinds of countries. Then I'd say the second bucket are those frontline states. And by frontline states, I mean those on the border with Russia. So the Baltic states, Poland, Finland, those kinds of countries who are really concerned because they have an aggressive neighbour. And so they're deeply concerned. And there what we may see is that they turn to make bilateral deals with Trump, particularly in the security realm, so defence deals, because they'll try and buy his support, essentially. They know that he's transactional. And then the third bucket are, I mean, we heard about them, Orban, Meloni, are the supporters of Trump in Europe. And those are the really concerning ones, because what they share with Trump are views on the perceived existential threat of migration, the need for so-called traditional family values. They are quote-unquote kind of anti-wokeism, and that's what they share. But fundamentally, what these group of people represent in Europe and in the EU, so Orban, Meloni, Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, is that they undermine the EU and they want to hollow out the EU from within. And so that represents a direct threat to European unity at a time when it's most needed.
Of course, they say they want to reform the EU from the inside rather than destroy it. And when you say concerns, I mean, Brussels or France or Germany may be concerned about those leaders, but can't it actually also be an advantage in this case? The EU desperately needs a bridge to Washington under Donald Trump. He turned his ire towards the EU, particularly on trade, but also on defence matters. And the UK looks like it could get caught in a trade war, possibly, between the US and the EU. Viktor Orban, I mean, he's a real outsider, insider, isn't he? Because he's also close to Vladimir Putin in Moscow. But perhaps Giorgia Meloni could be the woman.
I think Giorgia Meloni is going to be the one to watch, because we know that in the past, you know, she was pro-Putin, pro-Russia, anti-Ukraine, anti-NATO, and since being elected in 2022 has changed her tune. She probably realised that she needed the EU's COVID recovery funds for her country. But I think she will feel emboldened. So she's one to watch. What I will also say is Mark Rutte actually had quite a good relationship with Trump.
This is Mark Rutte, the former Prime Minister of the Netherlands, who's now heads up NATO.
Exactly. And given Trump's feelings about NATO and yet how essential NATO is to European security, Rutte as NATO Secretary will have a huge role to kind of keep the US engaged in European security.
Mm. You mentioned the word emboldened there, because I know that's definitely a concern amongst, if we label them like this now, more traditional politicians in Europe, that a Trump victory will embolden the populist nationalists in their own country. You have Emmanuel Macron. He looks over his shoulder at Marine Le Pen. He's got a very unstable government and many name him a lame duck president now. We've already spoken on the programme about Germany heading towards a snap election, with the AfD on the hard right doing very well, but you have the hard left there as well. But don't these traditional politicians ignore migration, rising costs of living, feeling they're being patronised by traditional politicians at their peril? Because these are common concerns that we saw now in the United States.
Yes, and I think especially the kind of issues around migration are shared across the US and Europe, even though the nature of the problem is slightly different. But they are huge concerns. And so those politicians who still believe in liberal democracies need to start telling a far more compelling counter narrative to their voters, which does take into account their genuine concerns about some of these issues.
Amida Van Rij, Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
It was a busy week at the COVID inquiry, with the Chief Executive of NHS England giving evidence. Amanda Pritchard told the inquiry that the government blocked a request to fund another 10,000 hospital beds at the height of the pandemic. She said the decision made by the Treasury in July 2020 had been very disappointing and has made it more difficult to tackle record waiting lists for planned treatment. As ever, our health reporter Jim Reid has been watching all the evidence for us.
Just bring the back of the bed, see if that helps. And is he on 100% now?
At the start of 2021, hospitals were under intense pressure.
Keep it sat below 96.
And some intensive care units were in danger of being overwhelmed.
We were 20 beds away from being overrun.
People just dying and dying and dying, you know, it's every day.
Ms Pritchard, your full name, please.
Amanda Kate Pritchard.
This week, we heard from the person now running the NHS in England.
If I suggested to you we were on the brink at times in January 2021, would you disagree, Ms Pritchard?
No. You know, I was talking to people who were in hospitals, in intensive care units, and we were very close at times. Very close.
At the time, there were 95,000 staffed hospital beds in England. Amanda Pritchard said that the NHS did ask the government to pay for 10,000 more.
To look at.
But that was turned down by the Treasury and Number 10.
What were the consequences of that 10,000 bed request being refused from your perspective?
It was, as you say, very disappointing. We could certainly have treated thousands more patients if we had had that additional headroom, as well as being more resilient going into the second wave and into winter more generally. Clearly, we could have done with that capacity at the time, and I think we'd be in a quite different position now.
The government has said it would be wrong to respond while the inquiry is ongoing.
Your full name, please.
Colin John Mackay.
Professor Mackay was the Chief of Medicine at Glasgow Royal Infirmary.
The first group of staff to be approached were those staff who had actual critical care experience.
He was asked about the impact on staff, particularly those who volunteered to transfer into intensive care to help look after the sickest patients.
I take it that there was some discomfort about the fact people were working in these conditions without having had the full training.
Yes, it would be fair to say that the impact on particularly theatre staff who had to be redeployed into intensive care was immense, and very much working outside of their comfort zone, managing patients with severe critical illness, many of whom sadly died. These were conditions that these nursing staff would have had no experience of before, and it must have been extraordinarily hard for them.
To try to relieve pressure, new temporary hospitals were built.
To declare the NHS Nightingale Hospital North East open.
The Nightingale sites in England were designed as overflow intensive care units.
Up to 460 extra critical care beds.
But they were barely used, partly because it was hard to find the doctors and nurses to staff them, and because COVID infections had peaked.
And of course, at this point in time,
NHS England's Chief Executive, Amanda Pritchard, again.
I suspect you know what I'm going to ask, but at a grand total of 358 and nearly a half million, do you think, Ms Pritchard, that that was a useful resource that was available to the NHS?
Yes, is the simple answer. We went into this expecting to need them. And if we had not had this kind of facility available at that time, this inquiry would be having a very different kind of conversation if we had ended up in that kind of scenario where we would have been unable to treat potentially many, many thousands of patients.
Other UK nations also spent millions on similar field hospitals.
I swear by Almighty God.
Andrew Goodall is the Chief Executive of NHS Wales.
Because of the change and the mitigating factors, the lockdown that occurred, we ended up not needing to use the field hospitals as intended, of course. So there was a real change on it. They were a contingency preparation, and unfortunately, they did not need to be used in the way that was intended.
Next week, as this part of the inquiry draws to a close, we'll hear testimony from senior politicians from the time, including Matt Hancock and other former health ministers from across the UK.
And that was Jim Reid, our health reporter there. The time is 9:05.
And we're going to close the programme by talking about a remarkable project. It's called the Sound Voice Project, and it explores the impact of losing your voice on a person's identity. To be clear, this isn't about temporarily losing your voice because you've got a cold or a flu. This is more about people who have, for instance, undergone a laryngectomy due to illness or cancer. The voices of patients are recorded alongside the voices of professional opera singers to create a 20-minute long installation that takes the audience through three stories. Here's a little bit of it.
I like the way I sound.
This is how Mommy sounds.
We heard a bit of the voice of Tanya Borge there, and we're going to speak to Tanya in a moment. Just before that, Hannah Conway is the award-winning composer behind the project. Hannah, good morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations on the project. And it all started with your dad, is that right?
Well, I guess my dad losing his speech was definitely the catalyst for me wanting to deeply explore and think about what it means to have a voice and what it means when voice is lost. Definitely,
and,
yes.
And what have you learned about how it affects people through the making of this this remarkable project?
Well, we drew together the most extraordinary group of people. Hazel Gould, the wonderful writer Hazel Gould, and I created this piece with people who had lost their voice due to Parkinson's disease, motor neuron disease, people who had throat cancer, medical professionals in healthcare, surgeons, biomedical researchers making implantable larynxes, technology companies who were developing synthesized voice, and bringing these people together who'd never met in the same room together as such. Well, we learned that actually the voice is integral to who you are and to how people perceive you as well. So it's difficult to summarize in a single sentence, but it's just something we never think about, just how important this kind of vocal, it's like a fingerprint.
And we should think about it more, particularly if we work on the radio, I guess. Let me bring in Tanya Borge. So Tanya, as I understand it, you had your laryngectomy after being diagnosed with a very rare throat cancer.
Yes, I did. I had my laryngectomy right at the beginning of the pandemic. So it was in March 2020. The day that we went into lockdown, in fact, only a week after I'd been diagnosed with quite a rare form of throat cancer.
And how do you feel that losing your voice initially and then getting it back to where it is now, how has that affected you and your confidence and your identity?
Hugely. I mean, it's hard to kind of summarise, but for me personally, you know, I know there is a small laryngectomy community and it affects everybody in different ways. But personally, for me, I was a young woman. I was 38. It's quite a young age. I'm certainly below the average age to have a laryngectomy. I'm a busy working mother of two young children. So I go to work. I'm in meetings. I'm taking the kids to school and play dates and swimming lessons and all of those, you know, just very normal family.
Of course.
Life is quite busy. And so losing my voice, or my natural voice, I say, because obviously I'm speaking now and you can hear me. It was huge. I mean, my background was performing arts. I studied performing arts at university. I used to sing. Singing was a real passion of mine. So I guess in a way it was like losing a part of me that I have mourned, and it's been a real grieving process.